Okay, so this morning we're going to talk about, we talked a little bit about contracts last week. So, and we talked a little bit about the anatomy case before that. So this week we're going to talk about what happens when something goes wrong with a contract. So we have this meeting of the mind, the agreement between two or more parties. But that's kind of what everything happens when you enter into it. And hopefully, everybody that will be out here in this class and other classes that I've taught, you never have to worry about a breach of contract. But sometimes they do. And a breach of contract is where people, somebody doesn't follow or they don't agree. So we're going to talk about what that means, what happens in a breach, and then how do you resolve it, besides calling someone like me. Then there was a question, I think, last week from you. What's a tort? Can you explain a tort again? I said we'd get there, so this week we're going to talk about torts and what that all means and why that's relevant to you in the architecture profession. People get injured on project sites, or people get injured after a project is over, and why that's a tort issue versus a contract issue. And there are two different theories in the law, but they're both going to be relevant to your practices or if something comes around. And then there's this much more legal side offshoot that we'll talk about at the very end called indemnity and contribution. But again, it is relevant in, I guess the best way to say is allocation of fault. Who really is responsible? Sometimes you have a contract between two parties, but there's a third party that gets into the mix. And how do you figure out who's responsible if that third party gets injured, whether by contract or tort? And who of the people that are in the contract, the two or three parties or more parties that are in the contract, how that's apportioned out or allocated. So that's what we're going to talk about, indemnity and contribution. Like I said, those are pure legal issues, and I think even a lot of lawyers don't understand it very well, but I'll try to kind of break it down in real simple terms for you guys, the basics for it. So, okay. So when you have a breach of contract, what are your remedies and how do we go through them? So a breach of contract means the failure of a party to perform or fulfill its promise and or its obligations under the contract. You know, as we said last week, it's just a contract is just a promise. It can be oral, it can be written, and it's two parties that agree to do something. Now there's elements of it. You know, there's the consideration we talked about, and there's the offer and acceptance. We have to make sure we're all on the same page. So we have to have that contract, and is it valid or is it void or voidable? But if we have a valid contract where there's been proper consideration and the parties are in agreement with what's going to be offered under that contract, when one party fails to perform or fails to fulfill its promise or obligations, what do we do? That's the breach. That's the concept of a breach. So when you hear somebody talking about breach contract, as simple as it is you just didn't live up to your side of the bargain. That's as simple as it is. Okay? Now, why do we have contract remedies? Well, it says here, to put the innocent party in the position he would have been in had the contract been fully performed. So, there are expectations that come into when a contract is entered into. I expect that if I do these drawings for you, you will pay me $10,000. And you expect that the drawings for which you're going to pay me $10,000 are sufficient to build my building. Those are expectations between the parties. And if one party fails to pay or the other party fails to deliver proper drawing, the other party, that's what I call the innocent party here. I paid you the money or I gave you the drawings. The party that did perform, the innocent party, needs to be put into a position or place had the contract been fully performed. So that's what we want to do, why we want a remedy. Like, we had a deal, you broke the deal, what's the solution? It's not about punishing. Contracts that have penalties or punishments in them are not allowed by nature. Now, there are some elements where if something goes wrong, you can bring a claim, and when we get to torts, we'll talk a little bit about more about that, where you can get more than the contract value. So, for example, if I enter into a contract for you to provide me services, and you say, I'll do these services and I'm going to charge you $100 an hour for these services. And you end up, by the way the billing comes in, charging you $200 an hour, you have not only breached the contract because the promise was only $100 an hour, but you've lied to me because you're billing me $200 and you've buried it in your bills or whatever. That would be called fraud. Now, fraud isn't a breach of contract action, but fraud is some place where you can get a penalty. But the contract language itself doesn't allow penalties or punishment. So your remedy is to put you back where you should have been, which you had it been performed, but you can't get more from just the contract itself. Now, like I said, this fraud thing is a separate, we'll talk a little bit about that. There's this other thing called liquidated damage. There's some things we'll talk a little bit about that where there's agreements to actually why you can get more, but you cannot have a penalty. And if there's a contract that's written that says if you fail to perform or you breach, this is the penalty against you, the courts will strike that provision. They won't strike the whole contract, but they'll strike that provision and say you are not allowed to have penalties in this contract. Okay? Now, what are the types of remedies you can have? There are what we call the legal remedies. Legal remedies, for purposes of your understanding, is basically monetary damages. How much money do you get to make it whole, to make you whole? Okay, that's what we would consider a legal remedy. And so when you go into court, you file and you say, I'm entitled to these dollars for damages. And there's different ways we can calculate, and we'll get into that. There's what's called an equitable remedy. An equitable remedy is not monetary, but an action. I'm going to force you to do this. So if I was offering you to sell you my car, and you were going to pay me $2,000 for my car, and then I decided, nope, I'm not going to sell you my car. Well, the only remedy you have there, you can't get money for it because you were the one that was going to be paying me. The remedy there would be to force me, as an equitable remedy, to force me to sell you the car. The action is, you really wanted a car. That was the promise. If I said I'm not going to sell you the car, how can you be remedied for that? Because I'm the one with the thing you're looking for. So the court would move to enforce. And sometimes you've heard of injunctions where you stop things or whatever, but equity is about an equitable remedy. Because again, to put you back in the position had the contract been fully performed, but giving you money when you were the one paying doesn't make sense, so the action would be to force me to sell you the car. So that's an equitable remedy. It makes it, the whole process is to make things equitable so it feels like you did the right thing, or it is the right thing that was done. And then the last one down here, and this is what we'll talk about a little bit, why it's different than when you have this you can't have punishments in the contract. There's this thing called consequential liquidated or punitive damages. Now, punitive damages, by its nature, that term sounds like it's a punishment. It is, but it's for very narrow places. Like, if you lied to someone, there's a fraud going on. So that triggers, not from the contract itself, but the actions of fraud trigger other elements. We'll talk about consequential liquidated damages when we get to that slide. But those are the three types of remedies that you're going to see in a breach of contract action. Any questions on that? So we'll talk about breach of the monetary damages first. This is the legal. And there's different types of the ways you can get monetary damages. So there's different types. There's what's called expectation damages. We're going to have reliance damages. We're going to have restitution damages. And the way the courts figure it out is they look at what are the facts and circumstances that make the most sense. So the most common of all the types of damages is what's called expectation damages. And it's as it sounds. It's what you expect. And so it's making, again, going back to making the innocent party whole if the contract was performed. So in this instance, the injured party for expectation damages recovers the difference between the cost to complete the contract by another and the agreed on cost if the original party had performed. What does that mean? So in that context, let's say that you came to me, I was your architect, and you said, can you design me this house. And I said, sure. I will design the house for you for $20,000. Okay? And I start working on it, and then I don't deliver. And I don't finish the job. So you're going to pay me the $20,000, but I don't deliver the product. Maybe I do a little bit, and you pay me like $5,000 or $8,000 or something. You pay me along the way, but then I just kind of like, I'm too busy, I can't do the job or what have you, I'm out. So in that instance, you would agree with me that I breached. You paid me. That's what your obligation was. But you expected me to deliver drawings. I failed to deliver those drawings, so I have now breached the contract. You still need your house designed. So you go out and hire someone else. Turns out the reason why I couldn't do it for $20,000 is I way underbid, and it's going to cost another $10,000 if you went to another architect. He's like, well, if I have to start from scratch, it's going to cost $30,000. Or if I take the drawings that he did, it's going to cost X dollars, or maybe another $15,000 or something to that effect. But if it's just from start from scratch, the concept is you were going to pay me $20,000, now you have to pay $30,000. Simple math. If you paid nothing to me at all, if no dollars came to me, I was a promise of $20,000, and you had to pay $30,000, the difference is $10,000. I thought you were going to get me a whole set of drawings for $20,000, and now I have to pay $30,000. I'm entitled. I expected a set of drawings for $20,000. I have to pay $30,000. It's the difference between the two. Because you always would have had to pay $20,000 no matter what. You expected to pay $20,000. But now if you have to pay $30,000, now I pay $10,000 more. So the remedy there, if no dollars had been exchanged, the remedy there is $10,000. You would sue me for the additional money that you had to pay. Because you always had to pay $20,000. Does that make sense? Now where it can get a little bit different, and this is what you want to think about, let's say you had paid me $5,000 already. And then you had to go out and pay the $10,000 more to get to the $30,000. If I gave you no drawings at all, what do people think the expectation damages would be for that? How much should you recover? If you paid me $5,000 and I gave you nothing, and you had to go out and pay $30,000, anybody? How much do you think that you should be able to recover? $15,000. Why is it $15,000? Right. Now, if I gave you drawings back, I gave you the value of that $5,000 back, and the new architect could use those, then it may only be $10,000. So there's a question as to whether that $5,000 was put to use. So that is where the lawyers come in and you do valuations and everything else. But the example I gave was, you paid me $5,000, I gave you nothing. So you put in $5,000 already, and now you have to pay $30,000 total, so you had to pay $10,000 extra, plus that $5,000 was worthless. The $10,000 and the $5,000 makes $15,000. Does that make sense? The reason why I'm going through this is there's going to be a question kind of like this on the exam. I don't want to say there's not going to be any math on the exam. It should be simple math, but that's why I'm trying to make it as simple like this. So that's what an expectation damage is. You get what you expected for the value to which you agreed. So you always want to start in an expectation damages calculation as what was the first value of the deal. The $20,000 is your starting point. And how you figure out how much more you're entitled to is how much more you had to pay. And it could be, in this instance, $15,000 because you had to pay $10,000 more for the extra architect, plus the $5,000 was worthless. But if I gave you drawings back, there may be a calculation that maybe what I gave you back is only worth $2,000, so you paid me $3,000 extra, so you take the $10,000 and the $3,000, and you get $13,000. So that's where you start. You start with what the value to agree, and then you try to calculate on top of that. I will not be asking you guys to be doing valuations. If there's an exam question that says I give drawings back, I'm not going to say, oh, is it worth this and that? I just want you to understand, because that's much more complex than everything else. I just want you to understand, you start with what the value is, and that's what you expected to pay. And anything you had to pay on top of that are your damages and expectation damages. Does that make sense? Okay. Question, yeah.
So it's the extra cost plus any money not compensated for.
If money was already paid to the party that was performing services, yeah, if you didn't get the value of that back for you, you would be entitled to that. Okay? That's expectation damages. Yes, question?
So, in the example where you said the architect might need more money to get it drawn, so is it possible like renegotiate a contract to like add the extra cost in it, or are you paying that?
So, your question is if the first architect, his $20,000 was a low bid, and realized I should have been able to do it for more, or I could do it for more, so can you renegotiate the contract? The answer to that is yes, you can. The question is, should you? Because you came to this individual with all of the information that they presumably needed, and they said to you, I can do this for $10,000 or $20,000. You promised me you could do all this for $20,000. Now you're coming back to me and saying, oh, I made a math error. Oh, it's harder than I thought. Well, is that your problem? That seems to me that it's my problem for misassessing how much it would cost. But that's a great question because that's what happens in all construction. There is not one person in this room that if you go into this industry will not be on a project where there's something called a change order. We're going to talk about change orders throughout a whole semester, but I'm going to explain it to you now so you can understand it because your question leads into that. As I've said, and I will say many times during the semester, none of you will ever draw a set of drawings that has 100% of every single thing that will go into that building because you don't have to. The standard of care doesn't require it because you expect the contractor to know how to build things. So when you draw a wall section and you have just a portion of it, they're going to know how to bloom frame the whole thing. They're going to know where the nails are, where the bolts are, and everything else. You don't have to draw all those details. But there are times where your drawings may be incomplete in an area, and the contractor starts to build that area and says, ooh, this doesn't work here. How do we put this together? And the contractor issues you what's called an RFI, request for information, and they say, hey, your drawings don't make sense here. What do we do? And then you have to issue clarifying drawings just to make sure that the building is built properly. The contractor says, oh, okay, I can build that, but that's going to cost you a little bit more money. In that instance, the contractor is entitled to that change order because the drawings changed, and so they're entitled to funds for that. But if the architect comes back and says, I don't need to issue new drawings because this is what you should have known, and the contractor says, but this is going to cost me more money to build it this way, that's where your scenario was. Does the owner have to pay the additional money? The answer is arguably no, because the contractor should know that. And that's always going to be this question is in construction. Is what did the contractor know from their industry standards, what was in the architect's drawings, and should someone be compensated or not? I have a case that I've been working on for a number of years where the contractor came in and bid a price to build the house. And there were many changes on the project, but the original price for the house was too low. There were other bids that were significantly higher, and the reason why it was too low is because the contractor missed his bid. And what the contractor ended up doing was shortchanging a lot of the work. God, I can't put I can't install these fixtures in this bathroom, or I can't do this kitchen because I underbid the project. They won it, that's why they underbid it, they lowbid it, to win the project, happens all the time. And now the contractor gets paid, gets some change orders, gets some this and that, and it turns out the work was deficient. So now the contractor's coming back and saying, well, you get what you pay for. And the owner's argument is, that's not the issue here. You lowballed your bid. It's not my responsibility to make sure you deliver me the product. Had you given me the proper bid, you would have hired the proper subcontractors. That's all your responsibility. So my client isn't responsible or obligated to renegotiate. You can, and sometimes in construction that happens. Sometimes you just like, it's not worth the fight. It's not worth hiring me. There's lots of times that happens. But there are instances where you, as the innocent party, let's call, doesn't have to allow the other side to renegotiate because we had a deal. We had an agreement. We had an agreed on cost. Does that make sense? Okay. Reliance damages. and then we'll talk about restitution damages. Reliance damages awarded to an injured party who foreseeably looks to the future, relied on a promise, sometimes even an unenforceable promise. You acted because you relied on a promise by the other party. You did something because they promised they would do something for you. You get what you deserve based on the promise. I will pay for the car you buy. But that's not saying I'm going to sell you the car. I will pay for the car you buy. You go out and pay for, like, buy. Think of it this way. You're at a workplace, and your employer needs you to drive all over town and do all these other things, and it's beating up your car, and you want to figure out what you can do, and you come to your employer, and you say, you know, is there any way that we can get, like, a company car or a car that we can work for this so I don't have to use my car for personal things? Can we have it as part of the agreement of this contract, of my employment? The owner says, yes. You go out and buy a car, just get what you need, and I will buy it. I will pay for it. Okay? That's a promise by me to pay for the car. You go, but I don't have time for it. I'm too busy, this and that, but I promise you I'll pay for it. So you go out and you buy your beater to drive around, and that becomes the company car. And you come back to me and you say, I need $5,000 for the car I bought. And I say, well, I'm not going to pay for that. That's your car. You're using it. You have relied on me for your actions. And so the claim against me would be, I must pay you $5,000. So it still is a monetary recovery, but is a reliance theory as opposed to an expectation. Okay? The expectation damages would be I would be delivering you drawings. You would get something from me. In this instance, you relied on a promise I made and you performed an action, in this case going out and buying a car. And so you are entitled to get monetary damages because you relied on my promise. Does that make sense, the difference between the two? Okay. It's also, I want my money back remedy. That's where, if there was an unenforceable promise. So in an instance where there's a contract that you thought could happen, you give somebody money to do something and the court say, oh, you can't sell that, or it's illegal. Remember we went through the void and voidable contracts. But if you've already turned over dollars, the reliance damages, where you both parties relied on that contract being valid, but it turns out it's void, so you can get your money back. I relied on you. I relied on this contract. We can't have the contract. I need my money back. It would be unfair if I paid someone for something, and it turns out that they couldn't sell it to me, but they had my money. And then they were able to come back and say, oh, it's a void contract, it's illegal, and I don't have to give you your money back. I would be injured here because the promise you said you would deliver to me for the $5,000 I gave you, you never gave it back to me because it's illegal. Or it's void. It's with a minor. It's with somebody that doesn't have mental capacity. Whatever the issue is that we went through the void and voidable contracts, the courts will say, we will not enforce that agreement. But it doesn't make sense that the other party gets to keep your money because your reliance may be improper because it was a void contract or an invalid contract, but you still relied on it. You should get your money back. So those are the two areas where reliance damages come into play. Okay? Restitution damages is another one. This is the monetary damages. And that's the last one. We're going to just three you have to worry about in the legal side of monetary. Expectation, reliance, and restitution. Restitution is awarded as where one party has provided a benefit to the other, and the first party is compensated for providing that benefit. Or sometimes it's called unjust enrichment. The recovery for providing a benefit if the contract was actually performed. Okay? So, here's the one here, the example I have here. House burned down mid-project. So, I'm a contractor. I'm building the project. Turns out that the house burns down. I'm halfway through, and the house burns down. Now, or maybe not halfway through, but some portion of the time. and I have expended dollars to build that house. I've incurred costs. The fire's not my fault. Okay? It's not like I had negligence or I left some equipment on or whatever. Maybe it's a strike of lightning. Maybe the owner was there. Maybe the owner kicked over a can and it caught on fire. Whatever the situation is, I still performed as a contractor, performed services, and I have my costs. I should be paid for those costs. It's not fair for me to be the injured party but not have compensation for it. I should get restitution for the services and work I performed. That's one type of restitution damages in this, if a providing a benefit if the contract was as if the contract was actually performed. The unjust enrichment one is, remember the example I gave where a roofer's up working on a portion of the roof and they're there to fix a leak in the roof, and they see over on another portion of the roof, they see some place where that work needed to be fixed as well, but it wasn't part of your contract. Remember I talked about that, I think last week or the week before? So in that instance, let's say, and in that, we said that created a quasi-contract. It expanded the contract. So it created a valid agreement. So the question here is, what happens when the roofer comes down and says, Mike, I need the $5,000 for the roof that I fixed, and I need another $1,000 for the other shingles I put up over there. The quasi-contract was created because he was doing that and everything else. But if I say, I'm not paying you, that's a breach. And what's the remedy? The remedy here is what's called unjust enrichment. Because if I said to him, just go up and fix the roof leaks, and I said, it's leaking here, but he went over and leaked there, that's what created the quasi-contract, my failure or refusal to pay that additional $1,000 would be my breach. And the unjust enrichment is, my house now has $1,000 more of shingles and wood and labor to patch a leak. I'm benefited from that. One party has provided a benefit. I get the benefit of this roofer's work on another portion. Could have been a misunderstanding. Could have been I just said fix the roof leaks and he didn't think it was a misunderstanding. That's not the question here. The question is, I get a benefit from your services. You are the injured party because you put in $1,000 worth of materials and labor. I have been unjustly enriched. So you're entitled to restitution for your services and labor and material. So those are the two areas you're going to find restitution. Question?
Is there a limit that my scope of work increases?
So the question is there, in this type of situation, with this, whether it's a quasi-contract or whatever, is there a limit to this type of scope of work increase? The answer is yes. Now, what would normally happen in a contract, a good written contract, is going to say, the contractor shall not perform any additional services other than what's called the contract documents. And we're going to talk a little bit about capital terms and everything else. Contract documents are a term with a capital C and a capital D, and I'll explain that in a second. But the contract documents are basically the drawings and specifications. Here's what the contractor is supposed to do. A good contract will say, a contractor shall not go outside of the contract documents without written authorization, without written approval. But it happens. A little bit here, a little bit there. And so in that instance, the contractor may have a valid argument. Well, I had to do this, and so I should get paid for it. And then you can argue back and forth, you still should have come to me, and that goes back and forth. But if the scope goes too far, if it's not considered reasonable, if you can enforce that provision that says you can't do anything outside of the contract documents without approval, then the answer is yes. I'm not necessarily unjustly enriched. You aren't entitled to restitution because there was another portion of the contract that said, don't do that. And then you get some battling provisions in the agreement. Like you have a damage theory, but you're going to argue that the contract doesn't entitle you to that. So that can happen, but if the scope goes too far. So for example, my roofing example, the roofer that came to my house and fixed a portion of it that went over and did another one, had they re-roofed the entire house with all new shingles? Not a chance. And the courts would have probably said to the contractor, they wouldn't say it this way, but they basically said, you're an idiot. Mr. Hanahan gets a whole new roof house. He doesn't have to pay for that. You decided to take advantage of him. There was no agreement, and the fact that you did that doesn't entitle you to restitution. There's no reliance because you didn't rely on him to say re-roof the house. So there can be a question of judgment. The courts will first try to look at the language of the contract. Then they're going to look at the terms and the communication between the parties. They try not to do that because it's what's called parole evidence. You don't have to worry about that. It's a very technical legal issue. But they're going to first look through the terms of the contract and enforce that as written. And if you're the one that did re-roof my house and you're trying to get it back, well, it's hard to say expectation damages because did you expect to get paid for a whole roof? It wasn't in the contract. It's hard to say reliance damages because I never told you I'd pay you for the whole roof. I told you to fix the lease. And the restitution is that really within the scope of the agreement? Probably not. Arguably, I'm unjustly enriched, but boy, that's a big change from what the original deal was. So, did you have a question? Do you have a question here? Yes.
So, if you, in that example, would the owner still have to pay for, like, the original agreed upon price?
Great question. So if it was to pay for the roof leak and it was $5,000 to pay for the roof leak and it turned out that he did $15,000 worth of work, the argument is without a doubt they still have to pay for the $5,000 because that was the original agreement. But the additional $10,000 of re-roofing the entire house and that was what was asked for, arguably doesn't have to pay.
Okay.
Now, as your lawyer, if you came to me and said, I'm getting sued by a contractor because you re-roofed my whole house and everything else, what do? I would say, you know what, for $10,000, if that's the difference, you're going to spend a lot more money with me than you are with him. Offer him a settlement. Offer him something. Because you did get a new roof, and you're going to spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars litigating this. At the end of the day, you're going to pay me much more than the $10,000 you would have paid him. So offer him $5,000. And maybe you guys can all go away. He was an idiot. You don't want to pay me. If you pay me, that doesn't make sense. So there's ways to work out deals. That's business as opposed to law. But that's reality of life. So sometimes, and I will tell you this. I get calls all the time from lots of times where I employ this are homeowners. Average people, just like all of us, that they say, my contractor screwed up or my architect screwed up or whatever. And I say, tell me what the problems are. And I talk about the problems with them. And I say, number one, I can send you to another lawyer that may be less expensive than me, but really what you need to do is you need to figure out, do you want to spend your money with lawyers and being in court and the pain and anguish and because it's a very emotional situation at your house, or maybe I'm happy to call the other side and see if we can work out a deal or something like that, because the legal world is just a difficult place to be in, it's expensive, and it's emotional. So, another question.
Yeah,
for expectation damages, it was like additional money on top of what was being paid originally. If you have to, like, force them to do it through, like, a lawyer, like, where do those fees come in? The legal fees? Great question. So the basic question is if you get into a lawsuit, it doesn't even have to be expectation damages. The question is, the basic question you're asking is, are you entitled to recover your legal fees if you have to sue someone because they breached the contract? The answer is, it depends. You're going to hear me say that 100,000 times this semester. And what it depends on is if you wrote a clause in the contract that says, if there is a breach, the party who's been injured, which they often call the prevailing party, the party who wins, is entitled to legal fees. So you very often will see a legal fee provision in the contract. If the contract is silent, you cannot get your legal fees. And then there are all these interpretations about what the legal fees clause says. Prevailing party. What's prevailing party? And I will only give you one example how confusing it gets. Prevailing parties will not be an exam. Just don't worry about that, but I just want to tell you how confusing it can get in the law. Let's say I have a clause that says the prevailing party shall be entitled to recover legal fees in this litigation. Okay? And I build you a house. I'm a contractor. And I build you a house, and at the end of the project, you owe me $200,000 on my $2 million house. Or your $2 million house, okay? You've paid me 90% of it. You paid me $1,800,000 and you still owe me $200,000. And the reason why you're not paying me $200,000 is because the house is a shambles and it was so poorly constructed and you have to go out and fix a whole bunch of stuff and I have breached my obligations to build you a proper house. And so I sue you for that $200,000. Hey, I did my job. Give me $200,000, I sue you. Okay? And then you sue me for $800,000, or let's make it easy. You sue me for $1 million to fix all of those mistakes. Right? Now we have countervailing suits. One's for $200,000, one's for $1 million. Let's say we get to the end of the whole trial, and the court says, Mr. Hanahan is entitled to $100,000 of the $200,000 he's asking for. You are suing me for $1 million. You're entitled to $400,000 to fix the things. Okay? You're going to get $400,000. I'm going to get $100,000. Who thinks me getting the $100,000 is the prevailing party? Anyway, raise your hand. Who thinks you getting $400,000 is the prevailing party? We got one, two, so three, four. Okay, so we got some people. And it's okay if you didn't vote. The question, though, is what does prevailing mean? I had a $200,000 claim, I got $100,000. I got 50% of what I was asking for. You had $1 million claim, and you got $400,000. You only got 40%. I would argue I'm prevailing because I got more of what I asked for. You're going to argue because you're prevailing because you got more money entitled to you than what I was entitled to. And then it gets more and more layers. There's statutes in the law that talks about what prevailing parties and everything else is. So the whole legal fee thing is a nightmare when you try to figure it out. And I have drafted many legal fee clauses that go into asserting how you determine what a prevailing party is and everything else. But it is an issue, and you don't have to worry about it being an exam. But just that one example, where is it the value of recovery? Is it the percentage of what your claim is? Was your claim trumped up? Were you entitled? Like, there's so many things that factor into who's prevailing that it can become a problem with legal fees. The last thing I'll say about legal fees is just more of a piece of advice than anything else. And at some point in your career, you may be in the position of, unfortunately, of being in a lawsuit. I tell this to every party I've ever been in, every piece of litigation I've ever had. Do not ever go to trial because you want to recover your legal fees. The trial should be about the breach and what you want to recover for what's wrong. Many clients, because by the time you get to trial, have paid so much money in legal fees, and it's not an uncommon situation, certainly in the construction world, that the legal fees exceed the value of the claim. And so the only thing that the business people are seeing, not the only thing, but a important thing that the business people are seeing on their books are the legal fees. And if there's a clause in the contract that says I'm entitled to legal fees, they want to get all that money back. I didn't have to be here. If I didn't have to pay you lawyers and I didn't have to be here, they sued me. It's not my fault. I want to be back here. I want to get all my legal fees. I want to get all my legal fees. I want to get all my legal fees. And it may be a huge dollar, but it's the issues of the case that's important, because if you get to the end of the case and you haven't prevailed on your claim, you're not going to get any legal fees. If you think that you're going to get the full amount of your legal fees, courts rarely award total legal fees. I was told this years ago. My first big federal trial, I had a federal trial back in 2000. It was the first huge big one. It was a 4-week trial in federal court over in Michigan, and we had a legal fee clause, and it wasn't prevailing party. It was pretty clear. And we actually prevailed on the case 100%, so we didn't have to get into it to have there been a prevailing party. But it was very clear that we were entitled to our legal fees. And so we, after the trial was over and the judge awarded, because you don't know if you're prevailing until the judge makes a ruling. So we went through the whole thing, and we had all this money and blah, blah, blah. And we went to the court afterward. We went to the judge, who was a federal judge, and they're appointed for life, and they sit up there in their kingdoms, and they can do whatever they want. And we made this motion for the legal fees, and this guy, he got pointed to the Sixth Circuit. Really good judge, but he was a nightmare to be in front of. He was so hard on you, but he was a good judge. And he looked at me, and I was still an associate. I wasn't even a partner yet, but he liked me more than the partner. I think because I was the younger one, he kind of threw me a couple bones. But he would beat the crap out of the senior partner. Like every time the senior partner would get up, he would just scream at him. He was screaming at me, but just left. So we had to make the motion for the legal fees. I went and presented the legal fees, and I just remember sitting way up on his bench up there, and he looks at me, and he's like, Mr. Hanahan, I read your legal fees clause. And it says you are entitled to reasonable legal fees and costs, right? And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, I will tell you, I don't think any lawyer's fees are reasonable. And he cut it to like a third of what we asked for. He's like, I will tell you what's reasonable. And I don't think any lawyer that's ever in front of me is reasonable. So even then, I tell my clients, I'm like, don't go in for legal fees. So that's just a business advice. It has nothing to do with the exam or anything else. It's important, yes. It has to be factored into considerations if you want to go to trial. But don't go because of legal fees. So that's just that. Because judges don't think we're reasonable. Any more questions? Yeah, another question on damages. Your shop burned down?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the shop being the work for clients?
Yes.
The restitution damages, would that be coming from the client? Because it's their work that they paid for?
So, good question. So the question is, they had a place where they were had millwork, was it stored or you guys were creating or what have you, there was a fire and it burned it down. So the first answer is going to be, and that would be lecture number 8, is you need to call your insurance company. You have insurance to protect your property. That's where the money should come from first, and we'll talk a little bit about what type of insurance would cover that and where it would be relevant and how you can recover it. The more important, though, your question is, if it's their material, should they pay for it? Should they have paid for it from the beginning? Well, sometimes it goes down to the contract. Does the contract have you, when you are preparing it, are you in care, custody, and control of it? And so their argument, the owner's argument is going to say, is I never received that millwork, and I had no cause or reason to create the fire. That as far as I'm concerned, until it's installed into my house or into my office building or wherever it is, you own it 100%. It's kind of like if I was going to go, and I keep using the car example, so let me change something. If I was going to go buy furniture and I was flipping through the Crate and Barrel catalog and I saw something I really liked and they had a warehouse sale and I was driving there and that warehouse burned down, I wanted to buy it, but until it's mine, I have really no responsibility whatsoever, and any loss that Crate and Barrel would have recovered or had incurred, any loss from that fire, would be Crate and Barrel's issue. So the likelihood that anybody other than your company or the insurance company paying for it, in this instance, would be like the owner or somebody else would be very small. There can be, like, you can look into it. Let's say that, and this has happened on projects. Let's say that the because a general contractor doesn't necessarily perform its own millwork. They don't buy their own, they don't create, they don't build. Like a general contractor hires a bunch of people. So let's say that whether it's in the warehouse or even a project site, a company shifts a pump and the pump catches on fire because it's operating improperly and that causes the fire. Well, then the manufacturer of the pump could have liability because they provided a defective part that caused the fire. But in this instance, millwork probably had to do with some issue in the warehouse or what have you. So there wouldn't be a restitution. There would be an insurance recovery, and that would be a reliance argument because you pay for insurance, you pay a premium for insurance, and you rely on them that if something happens, they will pay you for your loss. And if they refuse to pay you for your loss, you're like, but I paid you money, I bought the car, I expended costs in reliance on you doing something. If you refuse to pay me under the insurance, you have failed to fulfill the contract, so you've breached, but I relied on you. That's why I gave you the premium. So the theory against the insurance company is more of a reliance damage argument, as opposed to an expectation, because there was no exchange ever going to happen between you and the insurance company unless there was a loss. So if there's a loss, that's why I pay the premiums. I relied on you to act if there's a loss. That's the action. That's the reliance. And if they fail, I get my damages for that. That would be the argument. So it's called a coverage dispute and everything else. But if you break it down in really simple terms, the recovery from the insurance is a reliance damage for you. Any questions more on that? All right, let's bounce to equitable damages. Equitable remedies for a breach of court contract. Sometimes money doesn't help. Sometimes the horse is out of the barn. Sometimes it doesn't matter how much money I get paid. It's harmed me. So you want an injunction. I want them to stop doing this. They keep driving all over my front yard. Or they keep advertising, saying my name. My old firm, we represented Pelé, who was a soccer player from South America. And Barry, I think he's South America, maybe Central America, I don't know. But anyway, one of the world's most famous soccer players years ago. He invented the bicycle kick. He used to flip up and kick his feet back. We also represent Michael Jordan. We represent a number of people. But the Pelé trial that we had was major because they used an actor. It was when Pelé was more older in his life. It wasn't when he was still playing. But they used not an actor, a lookalike. And they had this guy running ads for soccer shoes and other things. And he looked just like Pelé. The ad never said Pelé on it. But people that know this guy, the people in the soccer community, I mean, we all have our interests. And so, like, I'm a big swimmer. So if I felt somebody that looked like Michael Phelps or Mark Spitz or somebody else like that, I'd be like, oh, my God, that's Michael Phelps. And I might want to buy his equipment or whatever. They had this photograph. And they've done this with Michael Jordan. They've done this with other people. You can't get money from them to recover that because it's somebody selling. So you want to enjoin them. You want an injunction. We want to stop them from putting that advertisement up. Now, you could also argue there's monetary damages in addition to that. But the remedy here is a court order requiring or forbidding an action, an injunction. Stop them from doing that. Let me bring it back to the architectural world. So I was in a case where I got a call from a client. They were a major light manufacturer. They did high-end custom lights. They were still around. I won't say their name. But they had been retained by an architect to prepare them for this building all the lighting reflective ceiling plans. Okay? And then the architect ended up getting fired. And the owner brought in a different architect. But they used the reflected ceilings. The plans were transferred to the new architect, and we weren't part of that whole exchange from Architect A to Architect B. But the plans were being used my clients, my light company, design company, reflected ceiling plan. And my client was owed $450,000 from Architect A. We did all this work for you. We gave you all of our drawings. And you screwed us. You didn't pay us the $450,000. That's an expectation damage between me and Architect A. They weren't paying us. They weren't paying us. So we needed to figure out, well, what do we do here? Because the owner was using our drawings. The owner wasn't paying us either. Because we said, hey, you got to give us a drawing. We got paid. Architect's not paying us, so you got to pay us. You're the owner somehow. We need to get paid our $450,000. And I was like, nope, not paying you. But in that instance, so between me and the architect, that was expectation. We expect you to pay $450,000. We had an expectation damage claim there. Between me and the owner was unjustly enriched because they had our drawings and they were going to build the building from it. And they weren't paying us. But that would have been a restitution claim against both of them. So now I have two theories of damages, and I told my client, we're going to do something different. We can always go back to our restitution or our expectation argument, but let's do something different. They're in the process of building this building, aren't they? Yes. And they're using those drawings, aren't they? Yes. Let's file an injunction against the owner to stop him from building the building because they are using our drawings without the right. There was a copyright in the drawings. We own that copyright. So we filed an injunction to stop the project. This was a multi-million dollar project. I mean, if you imagine $450,000 for reflective ceiling plans, it was a pretty big project. It was a lot of work. It was many, many floors. It was a very complex project. And we filed an injunction with the court to stop them from using our drawings, which stopped the entire project. We got paid in 2 weeks. We didn't have to do these lawsuits about expectation and restitution and battle and file motions and everything else and go through. It cost my clients some money to do the injunction. We had to go into court. That took about a month, 3 weeks to a month. We filed it. We won the injunction. They paid us. Because the dollars that project was sitting there idle was going to cost that client so much, and they ultimately were going to lose because they were using our drawings. So an injunction has and can get a monetary recovery at the end, but the impact of it is it stops something from happening. That's when you stop. Injunction, I'm enjoining you. You guys probably heard in the news over the last 10 years of your life, there's an injunction filed. Somebody's been enjoined for this. You can enjoin people from everything. I mean, you can enjoin people from like using a fishing hole because there may be environmental issues. You can enjoin people from leaking chemicals. There's all these things. An injunction is to stop something from happening. Okay? That's that. Any questions on injunctions? Rescission. Rescission is like, I'm untying the contract. We have this valid contract. We are undoing it and returning both parties to the pre-status quo. Before, it's like the contract never happened. We're going to rescind the contract. We're going to pull it apart. It didn't exist. So I gave the example last week where my client bought the house in the subdivision, and the house was at the bottom of a hill at a cul-de-sac, and it flooded because the retaining pond didn't carry the water enough. They didn't want this house because even if they could fix the flooding issues, even if they could make it sure that they weren't flooded all the time and that the contractor came in and did what they needed to do and everything else, when they sold the house, they would have to have reported it by law that this house used to experience floods, that it was in a floodplain. They had such a bad taste in their mouth, and they felt that the contractor had lied to them about the whole scenario and didn't explain to them the whole process. But we went in and we argued there wasn't a meeting of the minds, and we asked the court to rescind the contract. And so my client got their, it was over $500,000 back, like they had never bought the house, and the contractor had the house like it was never lived in. So they rescinded the contract. It's rarely sought and awarded, though, because you have to show that it's such an egregious issue. There was either not the meeting of the minds, or the meeting of the minds was so nebulous, or in this instance, the harms were so great that the courts rarely want to undo a contract. The courts look to you and say, you were two adults or two sophisticated companies or whatever it was. You had this deal. We're going to always try to enforce the deal as it was first, as opposed to try to break it apart. If this was a common instance, everybody would be like, I didn't have a contract. So you want to make sure that rescission is only used in very narrow situations. Okay? I've had it only one time in my entire career where we've ever talked about rescission contract. That was the one. And we got it. It was pretty lucky, but we got it. So, any questions on rescission? Another equitable remedy is specific performance. A court order requires, so it's opposite of the injunction. Injunction stops something. Specific performance requires somebody to do something. You come to me and I say I will sell you my car for $2,000, and then I say I am not going to sell you my car. The courts force me to sell you my car because I made the promise. It's unique, whatever that might be. You've paid me the money. I'm now forced to specifically perform under that contract. The courts typically look at, if they're going to order specific performances, was the transaction, was the contract, was the agreement, was the deal about something unique? If I thought I was just going to get, like, you know, a box of nuts and bolts, they're not going to force the hardware store to sell me that box of nuts and bolts because I could probably buy it anywhere else. It's not unique. You have to prove that it's specifically required, that you can't get it anywhere else. That's one of the elements, is the uniqueness of it. So, what I have here is land is considered unique. I'm walking around and I see this piece of property, I want to buy it. It's on a street that I like because there's children on the street and it's got nice trees and the homeowner has the for sale sign on, and we come to a deal and then they say, no, we don't want to move. We decided we're not going to move. You can force the court to make them sell you that house because they're going to say, but there's a house three blocks over that's just as nice. Well, it's not the same house. Or maybe it's not the property. I bought this land because it was on a lake. I bought this area because it had farmland, or whatever it might be. So the courts, in certain instances, will actually almost by its nature consider it unique. And land, in that instance, almost always considered unique. Even if it's a plot right next door, the courts will still generally say the one you were going to buy was unique to you, and we will require specific performance. So it's an equitable relief. There's not monetary damages that are being exchanged. It's forcing an action. Opposite of injunction, which stops an action, specific performance requires an action. Now, the second part here down below is also relevant for specific performance. It will not apply to services, because that falls into the concept of slavery and indentured servitude, forcing someone to do something that they don't want to do. I use this example, but it's because it's simplest to think about. I'm going out and casting a movie, and I cast Scarlett Johansson to be my lead actress. And she agrees to do the movie. And then it comes out that Scarlett Johansson has a conflict, and she doesn't want to do the movie. But there's someone that's a Scarlett Johansson lookalike, or there's somebody else that could do that. There's very huge famous stars, I don't even know, like a Keira Knightley, or I don't even know, somebody else that was a wonderful actress, Oscar winning, whatever it is, and they are ready to step into the role. But you want Scarlett Johansson. I want Scarlett Johansson. I'm the one that had them doing the movie. I want Scarlett Johansson. She said she was going to do it. I have a contract. I'm going to sue. I want specific performance. I want the court to force Scarlett Johansson to do that because she's unique. I don't want Keira Knightley. I don't want these other people. I'm really blunt. I want Scarlett Johansson. The courts will never enforce that, because you cannot force someone to do an action as a service. Okay? Now, there may be monetary damages. You could say, well, I will lose money because I had the wrong star. I already spent this money to build it up, or anything else like that. Or I have a production crew ready to go, and now I got to go find a new lead, and that's going to take me another 6 months, and that's going to cost me money for my crew and all this. So you can try to figure out monetary damages for her pulling out, but the courts will not force an individual to perform services. Now, there's some weird things about this that come into construction. Is can they force a contractor to build a building? Are those services unique because they're forcing workers to work, and the builder's a unique builder? Are those things that you're forcing people to do services, or does that fall into it's something that is not considered a service because they're just construction and it's common? It's not clear on that. I haven't had a case on that, so, and you want to have a question on that about between, but just remember the concepts is that they're not going to force people to do action, certainly not individually. Okay? Questions on that? Yes?
A general question on breaches, like if for some reason they find that the contract is voidable from the start, then none of this is, the party that's injured is not, can't get any monetary. Like,
yes, the question is what happens if the court turns out that the contract is void or voidable?
Yeah, they hire like a crew that's underage. Or
right. Is the party that was the injured party because they weren't able to get the work done, or they had whatever, are they going to be able to enforce that contract? The answer is no. Now, you may be able to get your money back, and that was when we had the monetary damages, I get my money back provision. So that's going back under under reliance. So you relied on it. That's where it says is sometimes even it's an unforceable promise. So you had this promise with the kids in the neighborhood to cut your lawn, and you paid them money up front, and then it turns out, you know, you gave them $1,000 before the summer started to do your lawn for the whole summer. And they were going to do it, and they start cutting it for the first couple of weeks, and then they flake out, or they take a job in Colorado or whatever, and they never give your money back. That contract is void because it was with minors, so it's not a legal contract. But you relied on them to do that, you can get your money back. So the court will, on a legal remedy, allow you to get your money back. But even if it's an avoidable or voided contract. So, okay? All right. Other types of damages for breach of contract. Remember I said there, so we had the legal, we had the equitable, and these are the other ones that I'm going to talk about. So the first one's called consequential damages. Consequential damages is a theory. I'm not going to ask you a consequential damage question in the test, but I just want to tell you it comes up in every construction contract. So I have to talk about it, and I just want you to understand it, but I'm not going to quiz you on it, okay? Consequential damages, indirect damages, indirect, remotely caused by a breach. They must be reasonably foreseeable when the contract was performed. So the concept here is you're going to build me a candy factory. And I tell you I have to have the candy factory finished by June 1st so I can start selling candy by September 1st because I got to have my startup and make sure it gets FDA approval and everything else. But I want to start selling candy to the market by September 1st so I can hit the Halloween cycle. Okay? Pretty simple. Makes a lot of sense. and it turns out that you're late on your project, and you don't deliver me the candy factory doesn't open its doors until September 20th. So not only did you not get June 1st, you're months late, and I can't sell any candy until after the first of the year. I miss Halloween, and I miss Christmas. I miss hundreds of millions of dollars worth of candy sales because you were late. Now, the direct damages are any cost that I had to pay for you to be on the project site finishing your work, because our contract was about building a factory. It wasn't about selling candy. But I have lost money as a consequence of your delay. So the hundreds of millions that I lose, can I recover those as a consequential damage? It's an indirect damage caused by your failure. And so are you entitled to consequential damages? And the answer is, if the contract is silent on it, yes. But I will tell you this, don't ever enter into a contract, ever, without a waiver of consequential damages. Because invariably, almost every building you're going to do, unless it's like a homeowner building, like a residence, they're for a business, they're for operations. And if the building doesn't open time, that company is going to lose money. And if it's your fault as the architect or it's the contractor's fault in getting it done late, almost always the dollars that the business loses are going to be greater than finishing the project on time. And you don't want to have to carry that. So I would tell you that don't ever enter a contract that allows consequential damage. You just want to ask for a waiver. And most of the time it's mutual. Both sides will have a mutual waiver of consequential damages. That's why I say, often disclaimed in construction contracts. So do you understand what this consequential damage is? It could be it's lost profits. I mean, that's the millions of dollars that I didn't get to sell candy. It's lost profits. But there can be other ramifications from it. There's all these different, like, I have to carry my insurance longer before I turn it over. My bank loan's going to be different because, like, you guys probably don't know this, but a bank loan during construction, when the project is completed, normally the owner refinances because they can get money cheaper. It's more expensive to get a loan for construction because there's risks than it is to insure the property after the building is finished. So if you have to carry that insurance, those higher insurance rates for 4 months, that's a consequential damage. It's not direct related to the project, but the delay of the project causes as a consequence, in this instance, my example, the owner to incur more costs. The flip side is, let's say the owner can't get their act together and the contractor has to be on the project site longer. I got to have my project manager there longer. I have to have my trailer there longer. I have to all these costs that are related to the project. They're entitled to those. But let's say that the contractor had their A team on your project and promised the A team would stay on the project until the end of the project. And because the owner changes, the owner delays, the owner this and that, I, as the contractor, lost the next job because I couldn't send my A team to the pitch. That would be a consequential damage as a result of the delay to the project where the A-team was still working. And if I lost $100 million project, that would be a lost profit by the contractor. So it can go both ways. So the owner could have caused the delays or other problems on the project. It has nothing to do with the contractor, but they lose jobs. They lose business as a consequence of the problems. That would be a claim by the contractor against the owner for consequential damages. That's why you want to waive them. It's like, God, who knows what's going to happen in the future? I had a project where I worked on, it was a casino in Las Vegas, and we're going to get to liquidated damages, and we ended up remedying that. Because it's got to be a remedy. Like, if my candy company's going to lose hundreds of millions of dollars because they miss Halloween and Christmas, that's bad. Or if my contractor loses the next job, that's bad. How do you protect that? I mean, it doesn't seem fair. Like, you got to figure it out. So there's what's called liquidated damages, and I'll explain that in a second. I had this project, though, in New Orleans. We were building a casino down there. The money that they took in per day from just the slot machines, and it wasn't the money they took in, it was the profit. The profit this one casino made per day from the slots alone was $1 million a day. Profit. And so they said, we need our doors open. We need them open this day. Because every day you don't open, we lose $1 million in profits. It was staggering to me that I was like, holy cow. And this is a small little casino. It wasn't like some huge Vegas one. I can't even imagine what the Wynn and those giant casinos out in Vegas make, the money they make on a day. It's staggering. So it was really important for my client and the casino to make sure that the project was completed on time. And we said to them, well, you're not going to get it because there's this waiver of consequential damages. And they're like, that's not fair. What do we do? Well, we said there's a remedy that you can do, and it's called liquidated damages. So a liquidated damage is an amount, typically per day, where actual damages that you later could have, I actually lose $1 million a day for my slot machines. That you could calculate if the project is late. I actually lose that. Liquidated damages says we negotiate a dollar figure up front. So we all know going in before we sign the contracts what the risks are. And we figure out what that dollar figure is, and then we know that for every day we are late, the contractor's late, they must pay the owner. And it's a fairly expensive negotiation. It's something the contractors hate. They don't want to have it. Like, why should I be responsible for this and that and everything else? But there has to be some remedy for the contractor, because if you didn't have... It's a stick, basically. There's the carrot and stick concept. If you didn't have that stick hanging over the contractor's head, because they're never going to sign a contract that allows consequential damages, because then they would be liable for all these days of delay. They would never sign that for a high risk. But that's the stick. The stick is, if you don't finish, you're going to have to pay us X dollars per day. So that's in many, many projects. So, like, I have a couple of... of residential apartment building complex projects right now that I'm negotiating. And it's not uncommon to see something like $20,000 per day if the contractor's late, or $50,000 per day. What you end up doing is the owner will sit down with their finance team, and they're going to say, okay, we're going to lose this much revenue for not being able to rent out the apartments on a daily basis. We're going to carry this much additional insurance costs. We're going to have this much different cost for the bank loan. We're going to have to pay our mortgage that we wouldn't have to pay because we wouldn't be paying it because it's not an operating business. We kind of calculate the cost. I got to have my project management team, and you kind of come to a rough figure, and then you offer that concept to the contractor, and then there's a negotiation back. And so it protects the owner, and so that's where you try to calculate up front what would be, but it's very difficult. The back end, you're not sure. So you try to calculate that up front. And it needs to have this part here, a reasonable relationship to the likely and potential damages. So you have to tell them all of how the sausage was made when you give them that number, but it has to have some reality to it. I have worked on projects. I've represented a number of utility companies that create electricity. So like a ComEd type. And when we build their factories to create power, or a lot of times these power plants already exist, but they're coal-fired, so they have coal, smoke, and everything going into the atmosphere, so by governmental mandates they have to put in what's called scrubbers or AQCSs, which are things that clean the smoke. So you guys ever heard the term clean coal? Anybody heard that term before? So they talk about clean coal. There's no such thing as clean coal. Coal is dirty and black, and you burn it and it has smoke. There's no such thing. It's not like, oh, there's this magic mineral that we can burn and it's clean. No. Clean coal is when you burn the coal, when it comes out of the smokestack, it goes through this filtering system, and then they take those particulates and do something with it. And so when it eventually goes out into the air, it's 99% water vapor. But that's what clean coal is. But the concepts are, we build, like for many of these utility companies, I build in the back end of them, these scrubbers, these to clean the coal. If those facilities aren't up and running, not only will the EPA, on a certain period of time, not only will the EPA find them because they're putting out dirty smoke into the air, but if the factories aren't, if they can't make power, they're losing money to sell electricity to their areas around, because that's their business, they sell electricity. So I've negotiated the liquidated damages clauses up to $500,000 per day. For every day that the contractor's late, they have to write a check to the owner for $500,000. Now the contractors are like, oh my God, that is just such a penalty. Sounds like a penalty, right? Like, who would go into a construction? And these are these construction projects are like in the $300 million range, $300 to $500 million range. Okay, like you're charging me $500,000 a day on a $300 million project. That's a penalty. That's got to be a penalty. And I look to the contractor and I say, do you want to do actual damages? Because the actual damages would be in the millions because of how much electricity we sell. So it's not a penalty. It's actually a negotiated value up front. And so remember when I went back and said contracts can't have a penalty provision, liquidated damages is this carve-out. And you guys will have these on contracts. I'm talking about it here because you'll have these contracts in your business later on when you're an architect. It's a carve-out to the concept of a penalty because the courts look at it as a pre-negotiated amount between parties on a reasonable relationship of what could happen. And everybody went into it eyes wide open. But the first point that says cannot be a penalty, you actually write in the clause, these liquidated damages are a calculated amount between the parties and are not a penalty. It's kind of like the magic language you have in there. So the courts can't strike it. So it is a remedy, a contractual remedy that allows money to be paid that is above the value of the agreement of the contract. It has nothing to do with the fact that it was a $300 million power plant. It's a totally separate thing. And it's allowed even though it feels like a penalty. But it's because it's fair. And it's the stick you need over the contractor. Questions on that? Okay. Punitive damages. Now, like I said, almost never awarded for breach of contract unless there's fraud. Sometimes it's fraud. Somebody lies to you. I lied to you about it and why you were induced to enter this contract based on a lie. They're going to be, they may get punitive damages, but I've had. In my 35 years of being a lawyer, I've had 4 cases that involve fraud. And that's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of contracts that I've dealt with. And in every instance, the party that was accused of fraud settled because they don't want it to be public that they could have committed fraud. In no instances was it ever proven. And I've been on both sides of it, where my client has accused the other side of committing fraud, or my client's been accused of committing fraud. But the problem is, actually, even though you can get monetary awards for it, the problem is if you get deemed as somebody who's defrauded, it's actually much more detrimental to your business going forward than it is the fine you might have to pay or the penalty. But for purposes of contracts, generally you're not going to see this in almost every instance. Okay? And then this we already talked about, legal fees and costs. Normally not awarded in a breach of contract, only if the contract specifically says that. So you're my favorite student because you keep asking questions early and then we come to them. So I appreciate that. Just for, you know, keep asking those. They're good. I like it. All right. Any questions on these types? Now, all these things we've been talking about, the innocent party, what they can get. The innocent party can stop something from happening. The innocent party can force somebody else to sell you their land. The innocent party gets money for restitution or reliance or exploitation damages. All the things that we've been talking about are damages if the other side breaches and the innocent party gets. What do they get? Is there any obligation on the innocent party? The answer is yes. The concept is what's called mitigation of damages. A breach by one party does not guarantee a recovery or protection to the other party. Just because I breach doesn't mean, or you breach, just because you breach doesn't mean I will always recover, because I have an obligation to mitigate my damages. I need to take certain steps to minimize my cost. I can't take the fact that you were building me this apartment complex and you stopped building it and I can't go out and say, you know what, I'm just going to let it sit around and let the steel rust and fall apart because I don't want to really work on it right now, and then in 3 years come back and say, you need to pay for me to fix this and build a whole new building. That's not fair. There's a theater company in Chicago that at one point in time, and I was never part of a lawsuit, I don't know anything of the specifics of it, but at one point in time, I saw superstructure and steel going up, and they were going to build something. I don't know if it was going to be a parking structure, or if it was going to be expansion in a different theater or whatever, and for some reason, the project just stopped. And it was like that, with the steel sticking out of the ground for like years, 2 or 3, 4 years. Eventually, they built something there, and like I said, I think they put in an expanded theater in there. But like, that steel was rusting, and that steel was sitting there. And if they, I always would go by, I'm like, boy, they haven't done anything to like take care of and clean this project site up. If they're going to have a lawsuit, they haven't mitigated their damages, or certainly they can't claim that this rusted steel the contractor is responsible for. Because once the deal is done and the breach has happened, the owner has to take care of it. The owner must try to minimize his damages. It can be significant in construction projects. I had a construction project where, toward this rust concept, we had material that was delivered to the project site. Then we ultimately terminated the contractor. We represented the owner. They were building an ethanol plant out in Iowa. And there was a bunch of steel sitting on the ground. And we got hired at least a year and a half, a year after the contractor had been terminated. And the steel rusted. It was just, and it was worthless. And we had to buy all new steel. And the contractor said, we don't have to pay for the new steel because when we were kicked off the site, that steel was good and usable, and you had an obligation to protect it, whether you put it in a warehouse, whatever you needed to do, but you let it sit out there and rust. So we're not going to pay for new steel. And they were right, because we didn't mitigate our damages. We had a claim for them to be able to fix things and do different work, and they did breach the contract and all this other stuff, but our damages were not going to be as much because we had to buy all new steel at an all new steel price, and the steel prices had gone up, and all these other problems that we had to incur because the owner didn't mitigate or minimize their losses. So you cannot take advantage of the fact, as the innocent party, that the guilty party breached. You just have to do your job to make sure that things are proper. Okay? All right, that's everything on breaches of contract. Why don't we take a quick 5-minute break if you guys want to do that, then we'll go through torts, and then we'll do really quickly at the end, we'll do indemnity and contribution. Okay? Okay, so what we're going to talk about next is what's called negligence in tort law. So negligence is a... So in the law, there's basically, if you remember way back from earlier slide, there's your contract actions where you have an agreement between a party, whether it's oral or written, but there's a contract between two parties. But there can be an injury where you don't have any agreement with someone, and that's where the world of negligence and tort falls into play. So I'm going to explain that, because obviously someone could get injured on a project site that you had no contract with, but they have an injury of which maybe your fault or maybe the contractor's fault or whomever. And so there has to be the law has to recognize some type of remedy for that. So what is a tort? A tort is an act or an omission, so a failure to act, that gives rise to an injury or harm. Injury could be physical, but harm could be something that's not a physical injury, potentially, to another, and amounts to a civil, not criminal, a civil wrong for which the courts impose liability, meaning someone caused the harm of the other party. In the simplest terms is, you didn't have an agreement with them, but somebody got hurt or injured, you caused it, the courts will impose upon you monetary damages for that injury. Simplest thing to think about is you get in a car accident. You didn't have a contract with the person driving that car, never met them, but they suffer whiplash, they hurt their neck. The courts will say because you caused the accident, you were negligent in your performance of driving, you were a negligent driver, they incurred a tort, they were injured, and therefore you must pay for their damages, pain and suffering, fixing their car, whatever else might come from that. That's your basic, simple tort, and negligence. It includes a duty owed to society and imposed by law to act in an acceptable manner. Your duty to drive that car certainly includes by the rules of the road and everything else, but you need to drive safely because society wants you to do that. Or if you're walking down the street and you want to walk in a straight line, but there's somebody in front of you, you can't just knock them out of the way because you want to walk in a straight line. Society says you must figure out how to navigate through a crowd, because if you knock and bump that person off the curb and they break their ankle, or they get hit by a car as they're falling off the curb, or some injury incurred, you have breached your duty to society to act reasonable. You were negligent in your actions, and therefore you should be liable to pay for their damages. Does that make sense? Okay. What's the difference between a loss from a breach of contract and a loss due to a tort? Loss due to breach of contract is defined by the contract, the four corners of the contract. The parties have come to a deal, and this is what our deal is. Now, society and your obligations to the world at large and everything else can factor into that, and we'll talk about that specifically with respect to an architect and its negligence standards and the standard of care. But ultimately, the contract and what your obligations are and what losses that can come from that are related to the contract. The courts will say, I want to read this contract or hear what the terms are first, and we're going to enforce that. In a tort, it's not contractually based. It's, did you act negligently? Were you reasonable in what you did? Is there something that you did that you owed to society, you owed to the general public, that caused that injury? And you can have that in, like, medical malpractice. We've all seen doctors and heard doctors getting sued. You know, they left a sponge in someone or what have you. Did they technically have a contract between the party performing the doctor and the patient? You could argue, remember we talked about that unilateral contract? When you go into the vet, you expect them to provide the services. But the doctor or the lawyer or the accountant or even the architect still owes a duty to perform in accordance to the reasonable standard of care. That standard is set by the general public at large as to what they're performing. So when a doctor leaves a sponge in something, that's a negligent action by the doctor, and they are liable for that tort. So when you hear about all these people that are personal injury lawyers, somebody gets injured and they go in, they get this multi-million dollar verdict, or the one that I always use an example in this class, but I think it's so old that none of you guys probably even know about it. Do you guys know about the McDonald's and the grandma with the hot coffee? Do you know that case? She was awarded like $94 million or something. It was just under $100 million because she burned herself on coffee that was too hot. I think it was down in Texas is where they awarded. There are certain jurisdictions, by the way, in the country where good plaintiff's lawyers will want to try to find a place to file a case because they are known for giant verdict awards. I think it's Marion County, Illinois. Downstate is another place you want to file it. If you want a big jury verdict, you do that. There's some ones in Texas. There's places. But this was McDonald's. Coffee was too hot, and this grandmother burned her mouth, and it was like $90 million they awarded. That is a tort because there's no contract. That's an injury, and your personal injury lawyer, the slip and fall guys, the ones that are medical malpractice, everything else, they all are handling tort cases because they're not contract cases. Okay? Now, there's an overlap in the world of negligence and contract law, and it factors into largely what an architect does, but this economic law school, I'll explain it to you. There's been hundreds of articles written for years and years and years. You will not have an economic loss rule question on the exam. I'll explain it to you briefly. But in your construction, in your architectural agreement, as we talked about, and we'll show you specifically when we get to the B101 in 2 weeks, it's paragraph 2.2, and it's the standard of care. And we talked about it. We said the architect must perform as a reasonable architect performing services for this type of project in this type of area. And it's very nebulous. And, you know, if I'm designing a house in California, it's different than I'm designing a house in Illinois and different from designing a house in Alabama. They have different parameters. Snow loads in Illinois, earthquake in California, neither in Alabama. So the standard of care changes. So you can't write in specific each and every code and everything else. So the concept of you performing to the standard of care is you are not being negligent in your actions. But you're like, Mike, negligence? Negligence is a tort concept. How is it in a contract? Well, it's because you wrote that concept into the contract. You are allowed to put anything into the contract you want. Well, you can't put a penalty clause in, but you can call it a liquidated damage clause. You can write that clause in there. You can write this negligence standard into an architectural agreement. So the contract now enforces the negligence standard. The negligence standard is about what you owe to society. So it's a little bit of an overlap. I just want to explain that. The economic loss rule goes into even more layers as far as what the injuries are and what the damages are, and can a third party that isn't part of the contract sue to get losses due to the architect's breach and their negligence here? It's too much layered. It's a concept that comes up. So I have the economic loss rule here. I have this as a bullet point to mostly say to you that if you are in an instance where someone files an action against you and there's a question about damages and economic loss comes up, call a lawyer. Because it's really complicated. But it does come up in construction, mostly on the design side, almost always. So it's something that's very common if there's lawsuits in the architectural world. But whether you as the architect are liable for it is depending on the facts, and so that's why you want to have a lawyer. So if the only thing you put there under your economic loss rule in your notes is if this comes up, call a lawyer, that would probably be the best. I will not ask you an economic loss question on the exam. So that's the difference. Contract is defined by the four corners of the agreement. Negligence standard of the tort is the negligence standard of the public at large. That's your big difference for that. Purposes of the tort law. We're ringing a bell here again. Same thing. It's to promote safety, promote predictability of behavior. That sounds like contracts too. That sounds like what the law does. We're out here to protect the people. We're out here to have predictions of what's going to happen. So the predictability of behavior in a contract is what's in the four corners of the contract. I will pay you this if you do this for me. We all know what those obligations are. Tort law, the predictability is when I walk down the street, I can't just walk straight line and knock people off if I want. When I'm driving, I'm not allowed to drive too fast. When I'm acting as a doctor, I'm not allowed to leave sponges in there. We want predictability. We want to be able to expect people to perform and act in a certain way. And the last part of tort law is to allocate risk or loss or injury. If I am injured and I incur dollars of loss for medical bills, or I lose a leg and that has a value to me because I can't run around and that changes my life, I should be entitled to compensation for that. And the courts will then allocate those losses I've incurred to the liable party. Okay? Question?
Is tort law part of the common law or the customary practice?
Great question. And the answer is, the question is tort law part of common law or is it part of custom and practice? And the answer is both, because custom and practice ultimately is enveloped into what is the common law. The common law, when you have cases that come down and they write a decision, look to see what does the contractor normally do in this instance, custom and practice. And then they put it into a case and they say, if these facts occur, party A or party B will be liable and party C gets a recovery. So the courts will take that custom and practice. They will put it and say, this is what commonly happens in the industry. They will put in case law and they will allocate damages from that, or what the verdict will be and everything else. And so, custom and practice, and then what ends up happening is, if the courts say, if A happens and B happens, then C must happen, then going forward, the custom and the practice in the industry is you must do A, then B for C to happen. So they actually become intertwined. The courts will rely on the custom and practice to create common law, but if there's some shift or their interpretation of it, common law then drives custom and practice. It's called precedent. You've all heard the term, the courts must follow precedent. So if I have a case that says if these set of facts happen, the outcome is X, the next court that gets that and the same or similar set of facts occurs, that next court, the next court in line by precedent, should be following what the previous court said. And that's how common law is developed. And those precedents create the custom and practice, but they're also built on it. It's a cyclical thing. One leads to the other, but they're all very much intertwined. Great question. Types of torts. So I've talked a lot about it. You had the car accident or whatever, but there's different types of torts. And there can be negligent torts, meaning you just weren't acting reasonable. You were walking down the street and you just kept in a straight line. Or there can be intentional. When I walked down the street, instead of me not only getting out of the way, but I shouldered somebody out of the way, I intentionally act. That's an intentional tort. So, let's go with the intentional ones first, because they're much more concrete. We can wrap our head around it. And be advised that intentional torts can also, and more very commonly, have a criminal sister or mirror. So we have battery. Battery is actually someone when you physically strike them. So if I'm walking down the street and there's somebody in my way and I drop a shoulder into them, I have committed battery. You don't have to fist them. You don't have to have a stick. But you have intentionally struck someone. You have bumped into them. You've done something to them. That is battery. We've all heard of assault and battery. Battery is the actual physical contact. That's a tort, and you can be charged criminally for that. Assault, putting another person in fear of imminent and harmful contact. You hear the term assault and battery. Someone can be assaulted without necessarily physically being touched. And often it is the combined. Assault and battery is a combined charge. But assault is just necessarily putting them in a fear of imminent harm that they may be physically touched. So you can assault someone by screaming at them. That can be an assault. Cyberbullying is assault. It also is a tort. That's why you get monetary damages as well as criminal damages. I don't know if anybody saw on Capitol Hill yesterday or 2 days ago, they had the 5 largest tech companies there. There was TikTok, there was Snap, there was Meta, there were 3 other ones, 2 other ones, I don't remember. And the people that were mostly there, though, obviously the senator, I don't know if it was senator, congressman, maybe it was a joint, I don't remember. But anyway, the lawmakers were people asking questions. But the people in the gallery were many, many families where children had either been committed suicide or had other stuff because of cyberbullying. And one of the cries from all the people out there is we need laws to allow us to recover monetary damages if there are these actions because people are being unreasonable for these types. And there are certain states that have now brought in and have criminal and monetary ability to recover monetary damages for cyberbullying and things like that. That's an assault. Because, you know, just because I put words on a screen and I hassle somebody, I haven't physically touched them, but I could have done something that assaulted them. Okay? So it can be both, like I said, a tort could be civil or criminal. Trespass. If someone actually goes on your property illegally or improperly, you don't want them on your property, that's trespass. That is actually considered a tort as well. Now, are you going to sue your neighbor in tort because they hopped on your yard and did something? But let's say somebody, this happened years and years and years ago, and my father handled it the way you're supposed to handle this, but my sister, this is when I was in college, my sister was still in high school, and some Friday night after some football game or whatever, a bunch of high school seniors came and threw eggs at my family's house. I don't know what they were mad at my sister about, I have no idea, but they egged the house. That's a tort. They have trespassed. They invaded the property, my parents' property. I think my dad found out who they were, made them come in and get them letters and scrub it off. That's what you're supposed to do. But that was a tort that was committed against my family's house of somebody throwing eggs against them. Okay? Conversion. Taking or destroying another person's property. So if I smash the car or I hit something. Or conversion also can be stealing from someone. Conversion in the criminal side is theft. On the criminal side, they call it theft. If you take someone's money, that's theft. So, false imprisonment or kidnapping. Kidnapping, we all know, is a crime, right? We've all heard of that. But you actually can get monetary damages as a tort because you have imprisoned someone. You've restricted their ability to do what they want to do. So I hear these stories of people that have been held hostage, these children that are lost, and then they're raised with other families, and then they finally find them years later. It's tragic. You can recover monetary damages from them because even though it is kidnapping and it was a criminal offense, you are also entitled to recover because it is a false imprisonment. It is a tort that is you can get a remedy. Intentional infliction of emotional stress. If you're screaming at somebody or you physically, not physically abuse them, you mentally abuse them. This happens sadly often in domestic relationships where one party has been just abused over and over. Intentional infliction of emotional distress is a tort that you can recover money from. And then defamation and libel. If someone said something about you, and defamation or libel has to do with whether it's defamatory, whether it's libel, has to do whether it's you're a public figure or not, if there's a distinction you don't have to worry about for the exam. But if you are saying something about someone, you can be liable for, and it's libel, not liable. When I'm saying liable, you can be liable for defamation, you can be liable for libel. But the two things, libel and defamation, are both when you are saying something about someone else that is untrue, and the fact that you say something about that person damages that person, their reputation or whether. You may say, she's a liar, and she did this, and she did that. And if none of that happened, then you have defamed that person. And if that person can show that as a result of you saying she's a liar, she did this, she did that, hurt her, whether it was her business or her reputation or whatever, if she can show that she suffered an injury because you said these false things about her, then you would be liable for that defamation. Now, a defense to defamation and a defense to libel is if what you said was true. So you can say whatever you want about somebody as long as it's true, even if it's a bad thing about them. She's a liar. She stole from me. If in fact she is a liar and she stole from you, that's your defense to a defamation claim. But you have to prove it. So it's an automatic defense if you're speaking the truth. It's not a defense to say, oh, I'm allowed to say whatever I want and all that other stuff. So, but that's another tort that you can recover monetary damages for. Question?
Like, if my employer is making me do something like something that I know is like out of the standard of care, and then I go and tell someone, like, this feels off.
That's a great question. So the question is, if you are being asked to perform, and yours was an instance where you were asked to draw something in a project that you think is out of the standard of care or against code, but you're being made to do that, and then you then explain that to someone else, are you potentially liable for defamation? I don't think you would be. Obviously, you would be risking and jeopardizing your job, and then the action would be is if I went out there and you are, if it's in a public context, you're protected with what's called whistleblower statutes. And there are actually, in those cases, because it's a tort. By the way, in tort, you can have punitive damages. It's not like contracts. In tort, you can have lots of penalties. I mean, I won't go into it. It's been in the press this last week. It was a huge punitive damage in the award that we all may have read about for a defamation case where the award was in the tens of millions and it ended up being in the tens and tens of millions what the final award was. So you can get punitive. But in your instance, if you were in a situation where you told someone that your boss was asking you to do something that was improper, would that be defamation? You have to prove that you were right, that what they made you do was outside of the standard of care and put people at risk of public harm. That would be the first thing, is your defense against a defamation claim. If they then sued you and you were able to prove that you were right and they were wrong and they terminated you, you could be able to get monetary damages because of a wrongful termination, and that would be value of your salary and, again, reputation and things like that. So hopefully your job and your employer doesn't ask you to do something that is wrong and nefarious, but the reality is that sometimes that happens. Sometimes you are asked to do things. I can tell you this. I have had clients that have asked me to do things that breach my legal ethics, and I won't do them. And I had one client a number of years ago. I was actually, I think I was still an associate, so I didn't have to make the decision because there was another partner. Yeah, I think it was right before I became a partner, so this is 20-plus years ago. The client had asked us to do a number of things that we thought were ethically improper, and so we actually made a decision of the firm to fire the client. And we moved to the court to say we no longer can represent this individual because we didn't go into great detail of it, but because you have to protect the client's interest, you can't divulge to the other side what your client may have done that was wrong. So you just say that there is a difference in opinion between the parties. The judge could have asked us for a private discussion about it. They didn't. They just let us get out. But that happened. So it can happen where you're in a situation. And you have to tread lightly, and you have to figure out what's the best judicious, what's the best reasonable outcome there. If you are, and maybe just in kind of to follow up your question, if you're in a situation where a boss asks you to do something that you are uncomfortable with in the performance of your duty as a designer or an architect, the first thing I would do is see if there's a colleague that you trust that you could talk about it to work through it and see if that's really what's happening or not, so you feel comfortable with that. If you don't have that trusted advisor, then for sure you need to go talk to someone in the HR department. HR, by the way, is not only there to help you if a male boss is being disgruntled or mean to a female worker, or that there's those types of things going on. I mean, those are the common things you learn about HR and discrimination and those types of things. HR can be for something like this, where you feel that there's a schism between you and a superior, doesn't matter about gender or anything else, over what you should be doing. And that's where I would go if you wasn't a trusted person in the firm that you could talk to. I would certainly go to HR and say, what do I do with that? And they'll protect you for that. So, any questions more on that? Those are the questions. Okay. Can we do this? Yeah, negligence. Okay. So I keep using the word negligence. You know, so we have a tort, but what is actually negligence? A tort is because someone acted negligently. What is negligence? So negligence is causing a loss or injury by failing to act in accordance with the applicable level of care and caution. That's why this concept that I talked about, the standard of care of an architect, is a negligent concept that you put into a contract. So it's the combining of all of that. But really, negligence doesn't have to be called standard of care, the term that we always use, but it's about care and caution. What's reasonable? So, different standards for different people. I, as a lawyer, have a standard of care when I talk to people about legal things. Even when I'm teaching this class, have to perform to my standard of care. If you guys go out and say, oh my God, I learned this from Hanahan, and you start talking about stuff, and you get it completely wrong, you are not in violation of any standard of care, because you're not a lawyer. You are not expected to act that way. But when you're out designing for your clients and you're working and doing drawings and specifications, you are to conform to a standard of care of an architect, or a doctor as a doctor, or an accountant as an accountant, or just a person as a person. There's a standard of care of not walking down the street in a straight line and not worrying about everybody else, or driving your car properly. Society-driven in many respects. I've said that over and over, so I think it probably makes sense. I don't have to go into that. Case law can help establish the standard of care. This goes to your question about custom and practice and common law. What ends up happening as the cases learn about facts and scenarios, they start developing what the standards people should follow. If this happens, you need to act in this way that creates a standard of care under common law. So the cases can drive that. And then, this is often a question of whether there's negligence, or the question of negligence, of whether you acted negligently or not in a case, is left to what's called the trier of fact. In a court, there are two triers. There's a trier of fact and the trier of law. The judge will always be the trier of law. They will make the decisions of whether, if the law says this, you must apply it that way. If the law says this, you must apply it that way. That's what they're always going to do, is the trier of law. But how the facts are applied to that law, of whether you were negligent or not, the trier of facts. In most cases, if there's a jury trial, the jury is going to be deciding whether you are negligent. The court's going to say, negligent means X, Y, Z. The law says negligent is this. They'll say something like that first bullet on the screen. But the jury is supposed to say, I've heard all the facts. Did someone act in the applicable care of, to the level of care and caution expected of them, and did that action or omission cause an injury? The jury will determine as the trier of fact. Some cases don't have a jury. It's just the judge. As we talked about, that's called a bench trial. And the judge wears both hats in that instance. But the trier of fact takes the facts and applies them to the law. How do these apply to what my understanding is? Any questions on that? situations when negligence is automatically found. In those instances, the judge nor the jury has to decide. Because if something occurs, they must have been negligent. The violation of a law is considered to be automatically negligent. If I commit battery against you, I have committed a crime. We all know that. I have struck you. You were injured. That's a violation of the law. That's a crime. If I then, the injured party, you gave me a black eye, you broke my arm or what have you, you go to jail because you injured me and you committed battery. But if I want to sue you for my injuries, I don't have to prove that you were negligent because the violation of the law, you have been shown to have broke the law, you automatically are considered negligent. I don't have to have the jury determine that issue at all. They must, by the mere fact that you broke the law, agree that you were negligent. And so the only thing that's proven in that instance is what are my damages? So, that's why it's relevant in the court law, because you already have to have someone establish that the negligence occurred, in this case, a violation of law. The other place where negligence is automatically found, and this is, we'll get into agency, principle and agency in a later lecture, but is a really simple concept. They're in the world of agency law, there's a principal and there's an agent. The agent is acting on your behalf. And anything, when they're acting as an agent, that they do is like you did it. Okay? So, I'm an employer. And I hire you to be my employee. And I hire you to go to a project site. And I hire you to take care of things. And you're my agent on the project site. And if you are negligent on the project site, I can be sued. And your negligence is automatically attributed to me because you are acting on my behalf. Now, you can be sued too, but I'm the one that owns the company. I'm the one that has the money. You're just an employee. They're not going to get as much money from you as they're going to get from me. I'm the one that has the insurance, all that other stuff, so they're going to probably sue me. And they're going to say your actions as the agent are automatically found against me. Okay? And we'll get into a little bit more about agency in a later lecture, and it'll help you understand that. But that's the concept of how negligence is automatically found. Question?
Does the agent have, like, any, negligence against them?
So the question is, so if the agent's out there acting and performing their duties and they are negligent, and the principal, the employer for this argument or this example we made, the employer automatically gets attributed to that agent's problem. Your question is, but can they go after the actual agents for their negligence as well? Yeah. So the answer is yes. Can they go after them personally, independent? Their argument is going to be, I was acting, this is what I would do if I was representing the agent. I would say, I was acting in furtherance of my duties of my employment. So you can't sue me personally. You can only sue me through my job. That may or may not prevail because there's an argument to be made that maybe the party that was negligent was acting egregiously and maybe got somehow portionalized outside of the scope of their job. And so they could be liable. So yes, they can be found individually liable. It depends on the fact scenario of whether they have, how they've acted and what ultimately was the negligent action. But certainly, no matter what, the employer in this argument, in this example, would be somebody that certainly would be sued. But it could be both. And we live in America, so you sue everybody. So yeah, they would probably be sued, and then you got to figure out whether you should pay to settle, to get out, and all that other stuff. But yes. Okay. Alright, let's go through the next slide here. So, if you remember, we had these elements of a contract. Not surprisingly, the elements, you have to have elements for a negligence claim. Because when you sue someone, these personal injuries that sue for the hot coffee, it's called a negligence claim. It's a personal injury claim based on negligence, and you have to have these elements you have to prove. So like when you're proving a breach of contract, if you don't prove all those damn elements, you lose. You got to prove them all. And look at that. They're almost the exact same. There's a duty. Duty of the contract. You have a duty of negligence. Duty here is the standard of care owed to others. It could be society. It could be as a standard of care as your profession. So the duty in the breach of contract case was what was in the four corners of the contract. But this is the same concept. You have to prove a duty. You have to prove a breach of duty. We just talked about how a breach of contract is. Well, a breach of duty is the same concept in negligence. You violated or you failed to perform to the standard of care you're promised to society. Breach of duty. Causation. You have to show that the fact that the injury or that the breach caused the injury. And that one is sometimes where there can be a separation. They call it a proximate cause. But there sometimes can be a break between your breach of the duty and what actually happened in the injury. And then you have to prove damages. And I'll talk about this one in a second. So, duty, breach of duty, causation, damages. Those are the elements at the highest level. We'll go through each one of them individually. Duty. For negligence, like I said, it's the standard of care in general. That's what you want to look at. And the standard can be applicable to individuals or society, or it could be to professions. It is a legal duty, because obviously all these would go into a court of law. It is a legal duty to act as an ordinary, prudent, and reasonable person would act. Ordinary and reasonable. That's all you have to do. You have to be extraordinary, you have to be special. You just have to be ordinary and reasonable. It's applicable to everyone. It's ordinary and reasonable. You drive to the speed limit. It's ordinary and reasonable. You walk down the street properly. Different standards for different people in different professions. Said that over and over. A lawyer has a different breach of standard than an accountant, than an architect. But the one I try to use as an example that's really interesting is, like, let's say we were walking down the street and there was someone suffered some type of physical ailment or whatever and fell down and was maybe having seizures occur or what have you. And I, as a lawyer, went up and tried to help this individual. Did something, maybe they thought they were choking, gave them the Heimlich. Maybe I tried to prop them up and it turned out that they had a neck broken or something that I did. I'm acting as an ordinary person who doesn't have any training in the medical industry. And so I probably could not be sued if in case what I did to try to help them caused further injury. Let's say I gave them the Heimlich maneuver and they weren't choking, they actually were having a seizure and my Heimlich maneuver had them, I broke a rib or they caused something else. Whatever I did was the wrong thing to do. They couldn't necessarily sue me because I'm not a doctor. I wouldn't have the medical training. But if a doctor did perform those services and did try to help them, would the doctor be held to a different standard? They probably would. Now, there's the Good Samaritan law, and there's some other nuances that exist out there, but yes, you have to act within your standard of a profession. This is one that's interesting. People with mental or physical handicaps are still required to act in accordance with the standard of care of which a reasonable person who is not handicapped. So even if you have a mental deficiency or even if you're physically handicapped, doesn't allow you to say, I can act differently in society. We can't start making carve-outs for that. And it may not be the fairest thing conceptually in certain circumstances, but you need to have some level of standard, and you don't want to have people starting to say, I don't have to act like everybody else because I'm in a motorized wheelchair or something like that. I'm allowed to do what I want to do driving down the street. I don't have to do whatever it is because I have this ailment or this disability. So you have to look at that. Now, you know, ultimately, the reality of human nature is you're going to factor it in because people are human and they use their emotions when they make decisions, but the law doesn't look at it that way. Okay? And then finally down here, people with a greater than average skill or levels of ability or skill are held to a higher standard than those possessed by a reasonable person with that level of skill. So, this is an interesting one in the construction world, but it happens with everything. If I am an architect that just goes out and just designs spaces, designs houses, I'm going to be held to the standard of care of somebody who designs houses. And then if I'm all of a sudden asked to design a hospital, do I have that level of skill? Well, maybe you probably shouldn't have hired me if I'm just a residential designer. So maybe there's an issue there. But some people that are higher skilled, and if you look at like workers and trades they do, you know, the work you're going to see in a $100,000 home is not the work you should be seeing in a $10 million home. So there can be this reasonable of what you're skilled, and that's where this first legal duty is, the sliding scale. You still have to look at the circumstances in which the services or the actions that you're performing surround you in. Does that make sense? You know, you kind of take a look at what we're given and what the circumstances are, and then we determine this is the standard of care this individual should follow. It's really difficult because it gets really gray. If I say I want you to do really high quality work, you may have a different understanding of what high quality means than what I do. And then the courts have to decide who's right or who's wrong, or is it in the middle? So, the reasonableness of a person's actions is a matter of proof. You have to prove that the other party was acting unreasonable. And then, because it's the trier of fact, it's the jury that's going to take a look at it. They get to say the ultimate, as I said, for my first year civil procedure teacher, the ultimate royal court of 12 cantaloupes get to decide what is reasonable. Like the judge in my big first federal court trial got to tell me that my legal rates, my hourly rates, were not reasonable. Because he was the trier of fact for that. It wasn't illegal. Legally, he had to award legal fees. But as the facts were concerned, he got to say what was reasonable. They get to determine what the reasonable standard is. And sometimes you walk out of your jury and you're like, oh my God, they gave us nothing. That's not fair. Or sometimes they award this massive, giant award, like the woman with the McDonald's coffee and she burned her tongue. And is that reasonable or not? So those things happen. And a lot of times the juries will not be overturned. The courts will say, they heard the story. We're not here to overturn juries. Our system is built that way. They thought that was reasonable. Now, what we get, and this is this last point here on this, juries may not be aware of the appropriate standard of care. Like, if you have your 12 cantaloupes there, and again, I'm not trying to disparage the jury system, because I think the jury system is amazing. So I'll move off of that, even though I loved it when my civil procedure professor said that many years ago. But when you have your 12 jurors there, and they're listening to the story, they probably all know how we should act walking around in the street and driving your car and being good to your neighbors and everything else. They may not understand what the standard of care for of an architect is. And they certainly won't understand the standard of care for an architect of a nuclear reactor. They need to be educated. Juries may need to be educated to what is the applicable standard of care. So you bring in an expert. An expert will say, in the construction industry, when we are building a nuclear power plant, the contractor should know A, B, and C. Or the architect should design X, Y, and Z. This is what they should have known, the architect or the contractor. The expert will explain to the jury what the standard of care is. So in your normal slip, trip, and fall case with a personal injury, where there's a car accident or somebody steps off a curb or something like that, the jury doesn't really need an expert per se in that. But if it's a medical malpractice case, you need an expert to come in and say, this is what a doctor normally would do. This is what the doctor here didn't do. That's why the standard of care was breached. Professional standard of care. So professional standard of care, we talked about it. I can kind of zip through the slide. It's when you're dealing with a professional. Doctor, lawyer, architect, accountant. They have their own different standard of cares here. Doctors, but you got to remember, there's no guarantees. When you're dealing with a professional standard of care, it's not 100% guarantee. As I said, you will never do a 100% set of drawings. A doctor can never guarantee that the surgery is going to go the way you want it. I had knee surgery in the summer. It's doing okay. I wish it was better. You know, like, it's actually, he's a great doctor, and it's probably just because it takes a long time to heal. He did my other knee many years ago, and this one's awesome, so I'm hoping this one eventually get there. He didn't guarantee me that I was going to be coming out and being able to, you know, play hockey like I used to do a year ago and everything else. He just did his best as a doctor. There's no way I could bring a claim against him because he didn't breach his standard of care. And I actually think he's a great doctor, and so I wouldn't do it anyway. He's a nice guy. But the professional standard of care is a level of skill and care under which an ordinary person of the profession would observe under similar circumstances at the same time and location. So you have to take them in the context of who they are and where they are and what they're doing. Okay? And then again, we just talked about it, when you have this case, you're going to have an expert witness. If you're going to have an expert witness talking about a doctor, you don't want to have an accountant on the stand. He should be a doctor. And if you want to have a witness talking about design professional error, you don't want to have a witness that's a contractor. She should be an architect or have an architectural degree. So your expert witnesses, and they, the individual telling or teaching the jury what the standard of care is, should be able to speak based on their experience, their understanding of the custom of the industry, their understanding of common law. That's what the expert's going to talk about here. And in cases, you have to, in case law and courts, you actually have to go through very specific questions and answers to qualify them as experts and everything else. There's all these rules you have to do to get them into evidence. But the basic gist is, if you are going to be trying to educate a juror on the standard of care, or a judge, or anyone, you need an expert qualified in the area about which the standard relates. Breach. Okay, so we had all the duty. This is the breach of duty. Defendant's conduct violated his or her duty. So you had a duty to society. What your conduct did is you violated it. You fell short of or below the standard of care. And it's ultimately this trier of fact will say, are you acting reasonable? Is it a reasonable person test, a reasonable profession test? The conduct was a dereliction of the duty imposed of the individual defendant. So as you acted, did you violate or in dereliction of your reasonable standard? If the defendant, so if you remember way back when we had the plaintiff and the defendant, the defendant's the party that's being sued, the plaintiff that's being claimed as to have caused the injury. If they're an expert or professional, the standard of care that was breached by the defendant is related to what's expected from that professional. So if you're being sued as an architect, you're expected to act as an architect. If you're being sued as a doctor, you're expected to act as a doctor. And it's the reasonable architect, the reasonable doctor, the reasonable lawyer. It's not the extraordinary doctor. It's not the excellent lawyer. Unless the contract says you have to be an excellent lawyer, it's what the reasonable lawyer is. Okay? Causation. Next element. Third element. A plaintiff must prove the defendant's breach of the standard of care. Okay, we showed the duty. They had to act reasonable. They showed the breach. They failed to be reasonable. I got injured. You have to show that their action or omission caused my injury, the proximate cause. They were the related cause to the injury. It can be both actual and it cannot be too distant in time. There can be a separation between the breach and the injury that doesn't create a case between them. Now, you don't have to show that the plaintiff doesn't have to show that the cause was the only cause. Sometimes there can be multiple. In a construction case, it could be the architect screwed up and the contractor screwed up. Both of them can be at fault. You don't have to show when you're suing just the contractor why the architect did things. You don't have to say it's only the contractor. You can have multiple causes in your projects. But you need to show that it's sufficient of one of the causes that is the injury. So in the construction world, if I'm supposed to build a wall, and the wall was properly designed by the architect, and I build it incorrectly, and the architect walks out and takes a look at the wall and doesn't see the defects, and then the wall falls down and injures you, certainly the contractor would be at fault because you can show that the wall was built improperly. It is a sufficient cause that you can say the contractor was at fault. But does the architect who designed it properly and failed to see it, an omission by the architect, and failed to see that the wall was built incorrectly, does that mean the architect is also liable? Possibly, if the architect should have seen it, if the architect should have understood that the wall was built correctly, if it was visible, if it was something they could, it depends on the contract. But would that be sufficient? Is the architect's failure to view it enough that the injured party could recover? Maybe or maybe not. Or it may turn out that 95% of the damages go to the contractor and 5% go to the architect because they designed it properly. They told the contractor what to do. Contractor built it incorrectly. It fell down on you not because of the design, which is what you hired the architect for. It fell down on you because it was built wrong. Maybe at the end, because the architect's not the builder, maybe at the end the architect should have seen it, but it certainly wouldn't have changed that it was built incorrectly. So there can be this kind of splitting of hairs of who's responsible and how the liability is assigned. in a construction case. I have a case pending right now that I'm working through that's a big issue. How much do we attribute to the architect? How much do we attribute to the contractor? And then here, remember, proximate cause is not the only proximate cause. There could be more than one, as we're talking about here, contractor and architect here. Now, the test of whether a cause is proximate or not is whether the results, the injury, was reasonably foreseeable. And the concept of reasonably foreseeable. It's reasonably foreseeable that if you built the wall incorrectly, it's foreseeable that it's going to fall over. And the courts are going to give this huge, broad interpretation of what's reasonably foreseeable when you get to injuries and torts. They'll be like, man, it makes sense that if you build it wrong, and something happens because you built it wrong, you should be held liable. They don't even have to say that it's reasonable that it would fall down, or it's reasonable that this was one part that caused it to fall down. They can just say, if you build it wrong, this huge kind of big giant umbrella says, if you build it wrong and somebody gets injured, you should have liability. So they're going to have this big spectrum. And that concept of when you're putting in a case, you are going to try to put in as much information to show and give that court that umbrella as big as possible. They're going to let a lot of information in to see what's reasonably foreseeable. Okay? Now, the but-for test is this causation proximate cause concept. Could there be a separation for? You have to say, but for their negligence, would the plaintiff have suffered that injury or loss? So let me give you an example. I'm walking down the sidewalk, and two cars come into a car crash right in front of me, and they are injured. And I keep walking and I step off the curb because I'm looking at this because like we all like look at what's going on with car accidents and everything else and we're all shocked by this and I step off the curb and I trip and fall. And I'm injured. I never would have done that. I never would have walked that way. I never would have stepped down. I wouldn't have tripped and hurt my ankle or anything else had that car accident not occurred right in front of me. And it was shocking and it was disturbing. But for my argument that accident, I never would have been injured. But the courts may say that didn't cause your injury. Neither of them hit you. You had a standard of care yourself to be reasonable to watch out where you're walking. And when you then tripped, you actually were the cause of your own injury. So you may try to bring a lawsuit against the people that caused the car accident, but you may not prevail because they had a duty to drive and be safe, and they had a duty, and it scared the crap out of you because there was loud noise and everything else, and so it shocked you and everything else, and that caused you to be injured, potentially, but not caused the actual injury. It was not the proximate cause. There was a separation or a break, and so you weren't able to connect, even though there was a duty to society and there was a breach of the duty, that your injury, and you did have damages because you had to go to the doctor, that their duty and breach caused your injury. There can be this separation. So if the but-for, and that's where it says the causal chain may be broken by superseding or intervening causes here. Act by someone else after the defendant's breach, which is so extraordinary that it's unforeseeable. Yes, people get in a car accident, but is it foreseeable for a bystander to, because they're not paying attention, to fall off a curb and hurt themselves? If I'm one of the two people in the car accident and I'm getting sued by the person that broke their ankle, I would say it's not foreseeable. Yeah, we shouldn't have been in a car accident, but it's not foreseeable that some bystander wasn't taking care of themselves. So that would be a defense to that claim. So you can make that separation. Criminal actions or intentional torts can break a chain. And then an unforeseeable act of God. You can say, hey, there's a construction site, and I was working on the construction site, and a fire broke out, and I was injured, and I need to sue because I had damages, and because I got caught in a fire, and I burned my arm. And so I'm going to sue the contractor, and I'm going to sue the owner because I had to work on this project. But the fire was caused by a lightning strike. The owner wasn't responsible. The contractor wasn't responsible. And yes, you got burned in the course of performing your work on the job. But that's a secondary and intervening cause. It's not because of the project. It's not because of the work you were doing. Finally, damages. Damages are intended to compensate the injured party for the injured suffering. Pretty simple. You should get monetary damages. There could be equitable relief, but damages are to compensate you for that. Examples of the type of damages in a traditional tort claim. If you lost a job, remember we were talking about your example here, if you got fired from your job for the defamation thing, lost wages. if there's a damage or injury to a physical thing, it's a cost to repair, and then pain and suffering. If you broke your ankle and you had medical bills, there would be the pain and suffering. Not only you had to pay the medical bills for the cost that you incurred, but you would also have the pain you would incur from your broken ankle. So pain and suffering. Those are traditional. Obviously, the cases can be in the millions of dollars. Design defects, and those could be as far as a lot more, they're going to be related to breach of contract, but there can be tort cases where they can be in the thousands or millions of dollars to repair. So it's costs that you would recover, damages that are types that are going to be recovered in a tort claim. Any questions on that? Plaintiff's own negligence. Possible defense. That defense that I was talking about where I stepped off the curb and I was the one injured after I'm watching a car accident, they would have a defense of mine because I was negligent. So it's contributory or comparative. I contributed myself toward the injury. Or sometimes in contributory negligence, even if it's two parties together, let's say there was this car accident and one guy ran a red light and the other person was speeding. So the person was speeding to try to get through the light or whatever it might have been, but there were two parties that had fault. Lots of times when there's a tort, it's not just one individual. There could be two individuals involved in this tort. And so you're going to look to see whether there's one party contributed and does that reduce the damages. So if it's $1 million loss, I had injuries and I was between my pain and suffering and medical bills, I'm entitled to $1 million. And you hit me, but I was also speeding or I did something to contribute. If I'm deemed as 30% at fault and I have $1 million in damages, it may be that I only recover $700,000 because they'll do an apportionment. This real quick, under the old rule, if you were 1% at fault, you got nothing. Most cases and states have gone away from that. There's a few that allow that. But under the modern, it's what's called comparative, and they balance what it is. And the swing side is 50-50. If it's more or less than 50-50, they're going to attribute dollars. But that's so. And these are, again, more legal stuff. I'm not going to quiz you on the difference between comparative and contributory negligence. Just know as a concept that there can be more than one party liable, even if they're both in the same accident, and the courts are going to look at both issues.
Mr. Duggan's face categorically that he looked very carefully before he pulled his car out. On the other hand, Mrs. Brady contends the same thing. It pleased the court to settle the decision entirely on the testimony of both of them. So I didn't. I just wouldn't have. Mr. Duggan, it is the opinion of the court that your neck brace is an overt attempt to change the opinion of this court, therefore clouding your testimony. I find in favor of the defendant.
Does anybody know what that clip was taken from? The Brady Bunch. Excellent. We got one of them. Thank you very much. That was Michael Brady who threw his briefcase, the architect, the most famous architect in the world, when I was your age. And that was his wife. And his wife was in a car accident. So there was a car accident, and there was an injury. And the gentleman that had his head in the neck brace had an injury. And so there was the duty to drive properly. There was the breach of duty of the car accident. There was a causal connection between the injury, alleged injury, but he wasn't really injured. He had no damages. What you don't know is earlier in the episode, one of the kids saw this guy without the neck brace the day before court, wherever he was out and about, and told Mr. Brady about it. And so he shows up with the neck brace to say, oh my God, my injury. And then he threw that out to show that he didn't have an injured neck. So we had a duty, she had to drive properly. We had a breach of duty, she didn't drive properly. We had causation that caused the injury. We had no damages, there was no injury. So the court found, in addition to the guy being a big fat liar, the court found that they would not be able to recover. So, I think last year I had one person. 2 years ago, nobody knew. So I so much appreciate it because I know this is a clip from the early 70s, you know, long, long time ago. But since I always talk about Michael Brady in the beginning of my first lecture, I keep my Michael Brady slide in there. But that is a duty, breach of duty cause, and the failure to have damages is an example. Okay, last real quick. We have about 15 minutes. Contribution indemnity. Here's what I'm going to tell you about indemnity. We're going to go through these slides. There may be a question on indemnity concept in the exam, but I'm going to go through a little more detail. This is what you need to know for the exam before we go through the slides. Indemnity is the following concept, and it comes up more in the world that you're going to be in construction and architecture, in this context. You as an architect enter into an agreement with an owner. There's a two-party relationship, owner and contractor, owner and architect. Or, owner enters into an agreement with a contractor. There's a two-party relationship between owner and contractor. So if something goes wrong between the owner and the architect, and there's a lawsuit as a result of that, that's called a first-party lawsuit because we have a contract together. We have a first party. We are directly tied to each other. Or if there's a problem between the contractor and the owner, that's again a first-party claim. They are directly connected between each other. Indemnity deals with third parties. If you design that wall and the wall falls because your design was incorrect, and a worker who is not from your firm and is not related to the project or just is there gets injured, that worker does not have a contract with either the architect or the owner. That contractor, that worker is a third party. Or maybe it's just a passerby in the street. Or maybe the wall falls down 4 years from now and somebody's just in that space. It's an unrelated third party and they have been injured. So they need to be able to sue you. So they bring a lawsuit against you as the architect and the owner because it's their building. And if you're the owner, you're going to say, I didn't design that wall. Why should I have to pay for the wall that fell down if it's been designed improperly? So the third party truly injured sues me as the owner, truly not at fault. I sue the architect in indemnity. I must say, you must indemnify me for the third party's injuries. Indemnity is a concept that always deals with a third party. Okay, that's what you need to take away from this. Indemnity is a concept dealing with a third party. If it's a claim between owner and architect, that's a first party claim. If there's somebody that's not part of that deal, it's a third party claim. And indemnity says, if I didn't do it, I'm allowed to bring in the party that did do it, in this case, the bad design, or if it's the contractor, the bad construction. So that's the concept. Question over there.
How many levels can you have, like, let's say they pushed it on the architect design, it turns out that it's the manufacturer's fault?
Yes.
So can you even put it on the manufacturer?
So can it go level to level to level? The answer is yes. And what ends up happening is that there's going to have normally, like, in the manufacturer would probably be on the contractor side because the architect doesn't normally buy materials and equipment. But the contractor, so let's say that worker is injured or the passerby or the person that's in the house later on gets injured and they sue the owner. Because that's the only person they know, the owner. You know, it's got the big sign in the building. It says Nakatomi Tower, so we're going to sue Nakatomi because that building blew up. Whether it's a Christmas movie or not, we all know about the Nakatomi Tower. It blew up and the people that are injured and lots of people died in that. They're going to sue the Nakatomi Corporation. The Nakatomi Corporation is going to say, maybe it's not the best example because that was terrorist, but maybe they're going to say that there was a pump in there that blew up as opposed to Hans Gruber blew everything up. But let's say that there's a pump that blew up and caused the injury. Well, you're going to sue the owner. The owner's going to sue the contractor. You built this building and you put in the improper pump. And the contractor's going to then go to the manufacturer and say, you gave me the pump. And so the indemnity is going to pass down. But the injured person, Holly, whatever her name was, Gennaro, because she was back to, what was Bruce Willis's character's name? I'm blanking on it. John, do we know? Come on. Do we not have any diehard fans here? John, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, Holly Gennaro was his wife. This is another reason why I don't know if anybody is into the conspiracy of the, what was that? John McCain. Excellent. Okay. So, anybody that's not into I have a running fight with my wife, whether it's a Christmas movie or not. It's a Christmas movie. And there's a reason why, in addition to being, they play Christmas music, it's at Christmas, and it's a Christmas party, the character, his wife, Holly Gennaro, who she was using her maiden name because they were separated, but then she took it back and at the end says Holly McCain. In the running script, the dialogue, when you actually look at the original script that was, her name wasn't Holly. They changed it at the very end of the movie because it was a Christmas movie. Anyway, if Holly's injured because of a pump, and Holly sues me, owner of the Nakatomi Corporation, That's a third-party claim because she has no contract with me and she has no contract with the contractor nor with the manufacturer's pump. So I'm going to sue the contractor and say you must indemnify me for Ms. Gennaro, Mrs. McLean's injuries. I shouldn't have to pay for it because your pump caused this explosion. It wasn't Hans Gruber, it was the pump. And so as a result, in this instance, we have the contractor saying, not me, I'm going to pass that downstream, and we're going to get to that slide in a second called contribution. You also have an indemnity obligation, Mr. Manufacturer. So that's what you need to take away from this. I'm going to talk a little bit more about what it is. But the ultimate concept here is indemnity is to make sure that if a third party comes in and sues one party, if that party that's being sued is liable or not liable because they didn't cause it, they are allowed to bring somebody else in to indemnify them. Indemnity is protecting me from that third-party loss. So, the contractual obligation, by the way, it has to be in contract. You have to have, only, I think in Pennsylvania is a state that allows common law indemnity, but pretty much every other state says you must have an indemnity clause in your contract. So just make sure you stick it in. It's pretty standard, but keep it, but sometimes it's not. So you got to have an indemnity clause in there. But it's a contractual obligation to compensate the loss occurred to the other party due to the acts of the indemnitor or the another party. The indemnitor is the party saying, I will protect you. So the architect in the contract clause says, I, architect, will protect you, owner, if some third party is injured because I gave you the wrong design. There's always three parties in indemnity action. That's the only 30,000 foot you got to take away from this. I'm going to go through the details a little bit more detailed, but it's just security against hurt, loss, or damage. There's compensation. You could get monetary gains if Ms. Gennaro, Mrs. McLean, actually lost or burned herself because the pump blew up. She should be compensated for her damages. Nakatomi should not have to pay for that necessarily. It's the contractor or the manufacturer of the pump. Deals with third-party claims. In construction, a hold harmless cause, defining responsibility, is they sometimes call it, I will hold you harmless, meaning I, architect, will hold you owner harmless because I'm indemnifying you. So they call it a, sometimes it doesn't say indemnity clause, sometimes they call it a hold harmless clause. It's just a different name. But I will hold you, owner, harmless because I, as the architect, or for the Nakatomi building, I, as the contractor, gave you a defective pump for that injury. And then it's really, at the end of the day, and this, as I'm explaining this, it's how you shift the risk. Holly's injured, sues Nakatomi. Nakatomi shifts that risk or injury to the contractor that actually did the wrong work there. Okay? Contribution, to your question, is a method by which a defendant, the contractor, brings in a third party because that manufacturer of the pump doesn't have a contract with Nakatomi. Only the contractor does. So Nakatomi says, contractor, indemnify me and hold me harmless. Contractor says, okay. And the contractor always is ultimately responsible for everything that his subs or suppliers do. So the contractor's not going to get away scot-free. This contractor's going to have some responsibility. So you got Nakatomi sitting here saying, I didn't do anything wrong. I'm really sorry for your injury, Ms. Gennaro. I'm going to ask the contractor to indemnify me. And the contractor is going to say to the pump guy, I'm going to bring you in under a theory of contribution. The pump in this example in the slide is brings in the third party. That's the pump manufacturer. And they're going to say to the pump manufacturer, Ms. Gennaro had $1 million worth of damages. We have to indemnify and hold the owner harmless because it's our problem. Contractor's going to say, manufacturer of the pump, you are going to have to contribute to that $1 million. And I think it's $999,009 and we only pick up a couple thousand. But however that apportionment is done, the jury will figure that out or what otherwise. But that's what happens is you bring in the third party, and sometimes it could be the pump manufacturer, the installer of the pump, the electrician. You know, there could be three or four parties that they bring in for contribution, and then they try to figure out the apportionment of that. So contribution is saying, I'm going to bring some people in to contribute to paying these losses. Okay? Indemnity is the same as contribution, but it's that one level down. It's a reimbursement. It's a distribution of it. So that's why. But in the states, you have an indemnity statutes, and then you have contribution statutes. It's a more of a legal separation of things, but the concept is the same. Is the party who's not liable, not at fault, brings in the parties that offer. And because it's indemnity, it has to be in the contract, so they only can bring in one party, and that then one party brings in all the other ones downstream through contribution because the law allows them to do that. Yes?
So would you say that indemnity is 100% liable, and then the contribution?
That's a great question. The question is indemnity, is it 100% liable? And the answer is no, it's not 100% liable, because there's a, in almost every indemnity statute and in interpretation of law, they say you're my contractor. I'm the owner, and you're my contractor. And I get sued as the owner, but I didn't do anything. I believe I didn't do anything. So I'm going to sue you in indemnity because the College General sued me. Nakatomi sues you, and you're going to say, you know, it was a defective pump. Maybe you admit right away it's a defective pump. Do you have to pay 100% because it's indemnity? The answer is no, because the statute may say, you are not allowed to, I can't force you to indemnify for my negligence. If it was a defective pump, but I didn't have proper maintenance, and that's potentially partially why the pump failed. Had I maintained it properly, maybe it wouldn't have failed as early, or maybe it wouldn't have failed at all. And you're going to say, well, maybe I have some liability, but I'm going to defend. So there can be an apportionment. So it's not 100%. There still can be a fight, and you don't have to pay 100% of mine. Now, there are a few states, Minnesota's one, I can't remember the other ones because I'm litigating that, where it is 100%. But in most cases, the statutes say it's going to still be an apportionment between me and you because we have a contractual obligation. When you bring in parties downstream, the electrician, the pump manufacturer, the installer, when you bring in those, that's going to take whatever percentage. Let's say the $1 million is split $600,000, $400,000. Your $600,000 is going to now be split between the four of you guys. And that will be 100% of the $600,000. So contribution tries to fill in all the gaps. But indemnity doesn't mean 100% automatically. Does that help? Okay. Contractual indemnity, you got to have a language in your contract that says that you need to have that. I would put that in it. It makes a promise to contract to indemnify someone, so you want to include that. Like I said, some states, including Illinois, have passed specific statutes that prevent one party from promising to indemnify another party for the consequences of their own negligence. See, you were ahead of the question just again. So, that's the question right before the slide. That's what that last bullet down there says. Is it doesn't mean indemnity is 100%. Illinois says, even if I sue you indemnity, if I have my own negligence, I, Nakatomi, didn't maintain that pump, you don't have to pay for my failure there. It can become split. Ms. Gennaro still gets her million, but it still can be split between the contractor and me, and then the contractor can split theirs downstream in contribution. Double indemnity?
Yeah.
Have not. Oh, really? I'll have to check that out. Maybe I can put that in my slide for next year. Interesting. I'll have to put that in. So, indemnity, like I said, is only available when their liability is derivative. Derivative meaning from one to the other to the other. It's a derivation from the liability. It's ultimately, as an owner of the Nakatomi Tower, this is why Ms. Gennaro sued me, is because I am, as the society tells me, as the public, is I'm supposed to have a safe place for her to come to her Christmas party. So that's why she sued me. She wouldn't know who the contractor was. She certainly knows who the pump manufacturers are. So I have a liability obligation to her. And it may be that actually, even if I did maintain my pump, there may be some money being paid by the Nakatomi Tower to Ms. Gennaro because I put her in an unsafe environment. But certainly the real liability was a derivative downstream. So the concept is when liability is derivative from third party, and then now we have our first party arguments between me and contractor, or the first party arguments from contractor and subcontractors. Again, very complex. The whole indemnity thing, derivatives, blah, 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 all that other stuff. That's why I'm not going to ask you about that. That's why when the amount of times that I have arguments with lawyers when I'm negotiating contracts, like sophisticated, intelligent lawyers that have been practicing for years, like this is like one of the things that I have written articles, I study, I really, like I kind of get off on how indemnity really is. And even with some of the best lawyers I know, they don't get it. I'm like, So that's why I'm never going to test you guys on it, because when there's the really, really good lawyers that have a difference in opinion, I'm not expecting you guys. I just want you to know, at 30,000 feet, it's a three-party concept. The person that's injured, that's suing it, is not part of the contract that existed, certainly in the construction world. If you're going to see a question on the exam, it's going to be in that world. You know, is this party entitled to indemnity? Or what would be the indemnity concept here? Whatever. That would be a work. And that's all you guys need to know. Again, this is another one, like the economic loss rule. If you want to circle this on your notes and say, if any of you talk about indemnity, say call a lawyer, because this is really a complex legal concept. So, and that's it. We are done. Any questions for today? All right. You guys have a nice weekend.